there, it was like a much easier and more manageable goal. If I was like, I don't have to do every boulder in the world, I just have to do the best ones. And so that's how I started kind of making lists of good boulder problems. And that's developed over time into, yeah, the quest for the best and top 100 list and everything.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. I don't know why. I'm more psyched for this podcast than almost any other podcast. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Actually, we should just start it right there. All right. We're starting it with what I just said. Eric Jerome, welcome to the podcast. Tim, please welcome Eric Jerome to the podcast.
What's up? I'm Tim, your dude. And this is Eric Jerome, a good friend of mine. I met Eric climbing a long time ago at youth competitions, but we've just known each other over the years and climbed together. And what's up, Eric? Thanks for coming on.
Howdy.
Yeah. Eric, are you a professional climber? Can we say like professional climber, Eric? I mean, you work in the industry, you climb V15. Oh. That's really putting you on the spot.
It's interesting you bring that up because I don't know if you might have seen it, but maybe like a year or so ago, I had like a really long discussion on Instagram through my stories about the topic of how we define professional climbing and like who is a pro climber, who should be considered a pro climber. And I feel like we could talk about that for an hour in and of itself. I am now starting to feel comfortable calling myself that because I am making a little bit of money just through climbing now. But I don't know. That's a whole other topic. So.
In that Instagram, because I remember it was quite long and like, you know, it was back and forth and left and right. But what did you end up saying? Like, you know, were your qualifications? Because that I think that's a huge climbing discussion, by the way, you know?
Yeah. And if anybody wants to look back at it, I'm pretty sure I saved it as a story highlight. So that's there. But essentially, I realized when I moved to Utah that all these climbers who in my brain growing up as a kid were professional climbers, like people like Ben Tresco or Dalton Bunker, didn't make any money from climbing and would never have considered themselves a professional climber. And then at one point or another, you know, I was doing a lot of competitions that are quote unquote pro competitions and making finals in pro level competitions. And then meeting people who considered me a pro climber, but I never was making very much money, if any, and I never considered myself as that. And so the question became like, if everyone in the climbing world views you as a pro, like, does that just make you a pro? Like, is it more important what the community thinks than how much income you're actually accruing? And then there's also a level of like how much skill is involved. And I sort of drew some comparisons to other sports, and I have a list on my, I have a lot of lists, I'm a big list guy, as we'll get into, but one of the lists I have on my phone that I started when I was like 14 or 15 years old was a list of everyone in the US who's climbed V14 or harder. And then over the years, I'd kind of like talked to people about that. Yeah, it's getting big. And people had like huge misconceptions about how many people were climbing at that ability level. And then I kind of compared that ability level in reference to like the total amount of climbers to say a sport like football. And just, I think ultimately, like, I didn't really use very good data. I just like used basic Google searches to find those figures, but like V14 was so elite that like you would for sure be in the NFL if they were to scale. And so then it, you know,
really in the ratios, actually I have yeah. Zero thought about that. I have no idea.
And then like, I guess what I was kind of ruminating on was like, maybe the reason that there isn't much money in climbers and climbers don't make a good living is because none of them think of themselves as professionals and they don't hold themselves to that standard. And so I'm like, maybe if everyone who climbed at an elite level and has sponsors, but maybe doesn't get paid, thought of themselves as professionals and called themselves professionals, like it would cause companies to have to respond with better contracts and terms and conditions, and would kind of elevate the level of everyone overall.
So that was kind of
what I was getting at there.
Thing a lot. Yeah, I think the whole culture of like what climbing is definitely pulls back, or it stops the progress of like the professional climbing industry. But I'm kind of actually just curious, like, because maybe we won't bring this up later, but just your personal thoughts, like, would you grant someone professional status more towards their skill or more towards what society thinks of them? What would you say?
It's not related to income at all.
Not related it's to just income, like, no. Yeah.
Okay. Well, oh man, I don't know. What do you
think? Those are the two subjective things, right? Because I think income makes it pretty objective. Like if you're getting paid, we can call that professional. But there are definitely climbers that we think that are, you know, extremely strong climbers who send V15 all the time, maybe aren't getting paid. And maybe would consider them a pro, maybe you wouldn't, because maybe no one knows them. But then also some other pro climber who doesn't climb that hard, who, you know, 100,000 people follow them. You know, I don't have a good answer for that either, but I would consider, I think based on like societal norms, that this person is more famous, is just going to be considered more of a pro because they're professional.
Yeah.
They're doing things for brands and business and, you know, events and whatnot. And, you know, I think that's what our climbing culture has defined as pro so far. So I think like my answer leans more towards that. But when I'm climbing with these people, I'm like, these are pro climbers. Like these guys are stronger than everybody I see or better.
Yeah. It's like they're pro level or like elite
pro level.
Level climbers, elite level. But they're not actually pros because they aren't like showing up in the community or being loud on social media or whatever it may be.
Yeah. I'm just going to take the probably unpopular position and say that there's not a lot of money actually in climbing compared to something like football. And so that's why I don't care if everyone started considering themselves a pro, you know, because they climb hard or because they put out good media. Like it's not going to change how much money goes from sponsors to climbers, in my opinion. It's just money drives a lot when it comes to.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Well, yeah, what was Eric going to say?
I guess I think that's totally just fair. My response to that, and I think I'm in a unique position because I do marketing for a climbing company, Kaya, as my job. And so I am working with athletes and I've been on the other side of that as an athlete. And I think even though, of course, there's not as much money in climbing as there is football, companies still take advantage of that. And they take advantage of the lack of confidence that athletes have to get away with just giving them shoes or whatever. So like when it came to me sponsoring athletes, I acknowledged like, wow, I could probably pay this person so much less than they deserve. And they would be psyched. They would be like, wow, money, you know, like a check in the mail. That's totally huge for like most climbers. And so it's kind of a weird position for me, but I was like, I want to give these people more than they think they are worth. And I think if all of them thought of themselves as professional athletes and like were going into every contract with the expectation of getting cash, then I think overall, like more people would be getting paid to climb.
But that's just a function of supply and demand. Like if one person values themselves higher, like there's always going to be a kid below them that just says yes to the shoes. Like I'm not saying
fair, but
I love
Eric
this.
Is talking just about the highest level. But he's talking about the highest level, like the absolute very best, you know, 50 climbers in the world. You know, even them have trouble getting any deal that's, you know, relative to their level because of how we start that, I think is more the, and then the next 50, right? Because you're right that like, okay, once people get paid, I think it's a curious thing. I think, yeah, I'm not.
All right.
I think this is a super deep discussion.
Yeah, I guess, just to put a pin on and make it, because I think it's like a good suggestion for people coming up, is that still when it comes to being a professional and working with companies, I know from being on, especially the other side, what you want from athletes is a return on investment, right? You're looking to spend a dollar on them and to get $1.50 out of that spend. And so that's a good way to think of yourself as an athlete too, and just understand, you know, if you know you bring a lot to the table and you can bring a lot to the table, then you can demand, more out of it. And I love hearing you, Eric, talk about how you know, Kaya and working is like, no, we want to support athletes. We want to, you know, help people out. And I think that you do get more out of athletes with that approach. And just on that other side is reminding people that there's still a transactional nature there as an athlete. Being a professional is recognizing what your role is in the climbing business world. And it's to provide an ROI for the companies that sponsor you, whether that sounds gross or not. It's just like, that's just the truth. You know, that's where money comes from. You know, LeBron James gets $1 billion to sell $1.5 billion of shoes, where, you know.
To answer your question, it pains me to say, but I think that you can call me a pro climber.
Oof, rough. That really hurts. Well, the reason why I brought that up before we just went on to a complete tangent is that, you know, we often bring on quote unquote pro climbers and we're, you know, tearing into their training habits, what they think on the wall. And we could do that with you because you're such an accomplished climber, but that's not exactly why we're here today. I mean, we'll get to that maybe, but, I was so psyched to talk to you, Eric, because of two projects that you're working on. And one is a YouTube series that you've been calling Quest for the Best. And I don't know exactly how related this is, but there's a website that you're working on. Is it going to be called Top 100? Is that what you're going to end up calling it?
Yeah, I found that there's a domain called .best. And so I was like, I should just call it top100.best. And I haven't purchased that domain yet. But and so hopefully nobody goes and swoops it.
We'll
they're very related to one another. And I guess, like, in theory, the top 100 website could also just be called Quest for the Best. But
So let's start out with what those projects are about and how you started them and why it's, you know, kind of something that took a hold of you instead of just, you know, ticking another V15.
Yeah. I think it all started because I was just too psyched on climbing and I wanted to go climb a ton of stuff. And I thought of myself as a completionist growing up. And I grew up in Maryland and I wanted to do every single boulder at the crag, the good ones, the bad ones, the easy ones, the hard ones. And then when I moved to Utah, the vastness of the world and everything just kind of came crashing down on me. And it was so overwhelming. I was so overwhelmed with how many good boulders there were. And so for a while, I was like, oh, I want to do every boulder in Little Cottonwood, but that's like a huge feat in and of itself. So I was staying up all night, like couldn't sleep because I was so psyched, like every single night was not sleeping for a long time. And it helped me to quantify my goals and objectives by writing it all down. And then further, it was like a much easier and more manageable goal. If I was like, I don't have to do every boulder in the world, I just have to do the best ones. And so that's how I started kind of making lists of good boulder problems. And that's developed over time into, yeah, the Quest for the Best and top 100 list and everything.
So is what you're saying that your goal is to climb the top 100 best boulders in the world? And that's kind of what that quest is. Is that like the culminating, you know, achievement that, would happen with that?
I guess so. I mean, that would be amazing to actually do the top 100, but the top 100 is always going to be changing and it's obviously subjective, but mostly it's like, I just want to have a really fulfilling life where I enjoy climbing and I get to go to beautiful places and be with friends and everything. And so, and I know I enjoy climbing great boulder problems. And so it's just an avenue for me to travel, climb on diverse rock, diverse styles, see a lot of places and hopefully enjoy the process. So like last year I was kind of running through a bunch of them and I decided, I was like, I think I actually need to slow down because I want to enjoy the process of climbing these 100 boulders in the United States. And like sometimes I was like forcing it by going somewhere when the conditions weren't that good or going by myself and being scared or whatever. And I was like, I'd rather have like a really great day and a really great experience on a really amazing problem than just tick it off. So it's mostly just a way to have a fulfilling life and also to share with people and inspire them. And people seem to really like that conversation. And hopefully it inspires people to travel to somewhere that they weren't going to originally or get off the beaten path or yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I watched a couple of them this morning, your Quest for the Best episode series on your YouTube channel. And I, the last one I watched was the Shield. And I thought that was so cool, just to like see you kind of, I don't know, it felt like, because that was a harder objective, I think, as far as your list went on YouTube. And also you kind of like mentioned your journey with it. You tried it, you know, like basically 10 years previous. We're also on the same trip, which was funny. Basically you had like done it in a couple of tries and you were just freaking out. You're like, oh my God, like, is this the shield? Like, I can't believe I did that. Like, you know, I just expected it to feel like harder, or like, you know, that it would take me longer. And like, I thought that was a cool way of seeing your perspective shift to like, it is the shield. You know, it's like definitely one of the best boulders. And, you know, you have this, you know, project, this process, this journey, this, you know, mission for your YouTube, and you just go and like have a session on it. And I thought that was like, that was cool, because it definitely can get lost where you're like so objective focused and you're like taking away from this experience of like, you're still rock climbing amazing boulders. Like, it's still fun.
So before we get too into the weeds on things like the amazing boulder problems, I guess the whole point for me is that I love this quest for the best. I love this idea of climbing on some of the best climbs, but what it really begs the question of, and I think what we're psyched to talk about today, is what is the best? Like, what does that mean? Like, why is one boulder better than the other? And, you know, how do we even think about that? And we can go into that. But I thought a good lead into that is why chase the best? Like, what is it about? Is it the experience you have on the climbs? Is it, you know, why does that capture your desire versus difficulty, or, you know, one of the other myriad of reasons we climb?
Yeah, good question. I kind of asked myself that the other night, and then I stopped thinking about it because it seemed hard to answer. I don't know. I mean, they are obviously very inspiring, and I do tend to have more fun on the better boulders. So that's like the easiest answer, I think.
More fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe it'll come as we talk about what makes something the best. How did this, I guess we're doing it with stars. And you know, what, why is there even a ranking for quality, or how did you determine the attributes that go into quality? And, you know, maybe a nod to some of the people's shoulders you've stood on to, you know, come up with some of these ratings.
Yeah, I definitely can't take credit for a lot of these ideas. Two people that we've discussed are Jamie Emerson, who was on the podcast, and my friend Max Olatukin, who, if he hasn't been on the podcast, you guys should get him on.
He has.
Yeah. But, oh, nice. Yeah. Both of them have written in their old blog posts about quality. And I think that was also a big source of inspiration for me going into this project. And so let's see, I have that document and I put their little write-ups at the top. So Jamie's write-up was in one of his old guidebooks, and it was in 2001, Brian Capps and Matt Wilder were discussing the problem that then became Singularity in Squamish. And I think that they were wanting to describe it to Fred Nicole to encourage him to go try it. And so they were like, how can we possibly describe how quality this is? And so then they came up with a star system based on different attributes of the climb. And then Max Olatukin continued, and he decided to kind of rank those star system, or those stars and those attributes, in order of importance, according to him. And then I'm trying to take it maybe a step further, and I have my own ranking of importance that, you know, in my opinion might change on, but it's a little different from Max's. And I'm trying to go further and dig into each of those individual attributes and say, okay, within these attributes, like, how can we rank one boulder to the next? And so that's just something starting to try and think about.
The attributes, and then the order, like, what are the order of attributes for them or for you?
So, yeah. So Max's went, the line was number one, most important, followed by rock quality, height, an obvious start, setting, and landing. So his had six, and he was saying like each one should be given a score of 0 to 1. And then the average is the star rating. And so in theory, there's a 6-star boulder out there, is kind of his thesis. And I think for me, a long time, line was the most important to me. But upon thinking about it further, I think rock is actually going to be my number one quality, followed by line, start, height, landing. And then like on the very edge of the spectrum of things that become less important are the scenery, the setting, and the movement is like the least important quality because it's so subjective. And
I was gonna ask. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you guys will be able to share that little diagram that I shared with you.
Yeah.
But
put it on Instagram.
I guess like on the one side is rock and on the other side is movement. And so there's objectivity and subjectivity, and there's always going to be some level of subjectivity in all of these. But I try and the reason I think that the rock is the most important quality now is because it's so, it impacts a lot of the other qualities so greatly. Like the start is going to be on the same rock, whether it's good or bad. And, you know, the line that you're climbing and the distance that you're climbing is all going to be on that rock. And it's fundamentally just like what you're engaging with. And so that's why I had that as the number one. And I think like rock, line, start, and height are kind of the things that are actually encapsulated in the boulder itself, if you're judging the boulder itself. And then landing, scenery, and movement become external from the boulder. And you could argue that landing is an extension of the boulder and the scenery as well. But really, like rock, line, start, and height are like the factors of the boulder itself.
Okay. Well, I definitely, you know, we just kind of glazed over it there, but I want to go into each specific attribute in detail. And I want to emphasize again that framing that star quality has that that Jamie kind of pointed out in his guidebook, and that the genesis is, I think it's really important to have that frame that what the goal was with that initial star rating was to be able to communicate to someone else about the boulder's quality in itself. But, you know, without seeing, without hearing any kind of feeling where, oh, I had such a great time on that boulder. Like it was so fun. Like it was so, it was such a sick day. It's like, no, let's take that away and just communicate to Fred Nicole, this project is cool. Like you need, you should come across the world to try this project. Although I gotta point out, Fred Nicole, you know, amazing climber that I freaking love. I wouldn't say that he was known for seeking boulders with high star quality. Like, you know, like look at some of his things like Terramare or Esperanza. Or like they're like, that's one's a drop off. One's kind of like a low ball in the hole with a really sharp hole. That's not a distinct line. You know, you could go up diaphanous or whatever. Just kind of an interesting side note. So I just want to set up that frame that it's like, this is a way to tell someone about how good a problem is in a more objective setting. And, you know, I just think that that's important to kind of start that out with recognizing that. And yeah, should we actually, even before we go into the attributes, you know, why, I guess, why not any other attributes? Like, I mean, we just talked about the frame for it, but you know, that's kind of how I understand it from how Jamie put forward the idea of where star ratings came from. But did you ever consider like the approach or like the history of a boulder or the movement? You know, is a boulder that's a 20-mile hike in like the same as a, you know, boulder that's a, you know, 5-minute hike in? Like how does that factor in?
Yeah, Jamie actually does mention in his little blurb something about the climbing's history, the climb's history being important. I think he's maybe since changed his opinion on that. But yeah, those things end up just becoming more and more subjective. So I think as things become more experiential, they should matter less, because ultimately, like I might really enjoy a 20-mile hike in, but somebody else loves roadside boulders. And so every time I was like dissecting each of these individual characteristics, I was trying to think of, okay, is this experiential or is this subjective? Is this the rock itself that we're talking about, or is this how I might experience this rock?
Yeah. You know, you're like analyzing, reviewing this boulder in a vacuum, just the boulder itself. And then all these other attributes can be mentioned, but you're picking stars for very specific attributes about a boulder that could just be a boulder itself.
Yeah. And it's like, maybe stars aren't even the best way to do it. Like, as I kind of made that little graph the other night, I was thinking like, oh, like maybe like this would be, because on that one, it's how many things? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, if you include movement. And so,
ooh, did you and
it's like, do
movement?
We do a 7-star system? Do we make, well, like movement is just like, I kind of put it at the end on that chart, not necessarily to say that I'm going to include it, but to like just show how things become more experiential.
I think it is good to, you know, as I brought up that question, I know that strays into the more of the subjective realm, and the whole goal is to be able to communicate something that's not experiential. But it's hard for me to get away from it because of it's some like sometimes even part of the climb itself that is objective almost requires the experience. So it starts feeling like it's almost an integral part. And I'm just, I don't know if I totally agree with adding movement to the star rating, but it's like, have you ever done the hesitator in Leavenworth? Do you know that thing? Either of you guys?
I've only been once to Leavenworth.
It's a V2 highball and it's called the hesitator because you get to the top and it's kind of got this overhanging scoop and you have to make a dynamic move to the lip. And it's really cool because it's kind of like a nice romp to this moment where you have to, it kind of forces that experience, which I think is interesting. You can't lock it off. It's, you know, it's not a wild all points off dyno. I mean, although you could talk about climbs that require that dyno, and it's like, is that like an integral part of the climb that's not even subjective because it's like a rite of passage? It's like, look, you have to do this. I don't know. I'm going way out. You guys, this discussion is going to be the most geeky.
Oh, this is going to, yeah, it's going to be crazy.
but it's just boys talking about good boulders. That's what we're doing. So I'm okay with that.
I had a question. I had a question that came up. Sorry, did you want to jump
on Tim, what about answer the hesitator, dude?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I think that would be a very different list. And that would be like a list of like the most fun problems or most unique problems or something like that. And that might be a better list. Like maybe someone should make that list, but
yeah. There's definitely like a lot of lists in climbing, and you know, your best quest for the best is a very specific list. And I think that's why it's fun to have this discussion. But I did have a question that hasn't been mentioned yet. Or maybe it has in one of your episodes or something, but, did you ever think about Reach being one? Like, Critically Acclaimed was your first video, and I watched that one, and it just came up on that climb because it seemed like the standard beta was kind of like reachier. Actually, I haven't been to that boulder, I haven't done it, but you know, it's pretty spanny, like Gastone sequence to this crimp. And I was just thinking, I was like, damn, that's like a pretty big reach. And then there's probably a bunch of other boulders that have like big reaches and stuff. Like, is that a factor? Like, what if, you know, you have this whole list and, you know, 60 of the problems, like my girlfriend's 5 foot tall, like what if she could never really like do them or try them? Like, you know, is that how do you tackle that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that I've been starting to think about more. And I was thinking about it a lot in the context of the start quality, because so many climbs on the list have jump starts. And I was like, is a jump start better or worse than a stand start or a sit start? And I was trying to think about that. And I'm coming to the opinion, I think that accessibility is important and that should be included as a factor.
But then isn't this the exact same thing as the hesitator? And I loved how you just, you know, push my question aside with like that kind of thing belongs in a different kind of list. Like that is really experiential. And so the whole accessibility thing, like it's true, but then that goes into the whole hiking thing. Like, you know, would it be good if it's 20 miles away?
Is it
1 mile? Because it's almost the same thing.
If I want to go to a 20-mile hike or not, or I hated a 20-mile hike, it's not the same thing as, you know, someone else who's 5 foot tall going to Evolution and being like, okay, I cannot reach this first move, like, you know, this way at all. You know, I can't even do this, you know, Gastone dunk way or like this big reach. That's a totally different thing than, you know, I don't like getting my foot really scrunchy, and that this move is best done, it's most optimal doing it with a super scrunchy foot sequence. And like, that's why I agree with like, okay, movement can be a subjective thing. And I actually was going to, my very first question was going to be like, why is it part of this list? Because I think, you know, common sequences would be something that I would look at in terms of best, but now I'm learning that maybe it wouldn't be. But I haven't had a good answer to this question. Like, what if you literally cannot do these things? Like, you know, what if you can't? And, you know, I thought the best answer was like, then that boulder doesn't apply to your list if you're short. But I don't think it's the same thing. I don't think reach is the same thing as accessibility to a boulder. The setting of a boulder, the whole type of quality, I don't think it's even the same list. But I do think a lot of people are going to ask that question. What, this is BS. Like this list isn't even applied to me. Like I can't reach these things. Like I can't do these climbs. And I don't know. I just thought it would be an interesting one because that's a hard discussion in climbing period. You know, you go to climbing gyms and also I've just been climbing with a shorter climber for a longer time. And she's like having all these questions about grades and whatnot. And she's like, what grade do you think it is for me? And I'm like, that's an interesting question. You're trying a V5. Clearly the sequence that you're doing is not a V5, but you're trying a V5. Is it a V5? That's another question. Is it even the grade that that it says it's happening? So is it the best boulder for this person? That's a super tricky, I think a super tricky thing, but obviously it's safe to say that you're questing for the best for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a great question and I don't necessarily know the right answer. And I totally hear you, Josh. And I think we could go back and forth on that one. And I don't know if it should be included or not, to be honest, but that's just where I'm at with it right now, I guess.
Yeah. I think my issue and why grading is different is grading is subjective. Maybe Tristan might disagree. Although I'd love to have him here and push his opinion. I guess I'm more swayed by the idea of it being subjective. And so if we're going to talk about if the constraint we're putting up is that stars are, a more objective way to communicate about a boulder and a line and that whole thing to someone, then the issue I have with it, Tim, is it's not that you're wrong. It's that if you could say this is reachy and so it takes a star away, but then something that might be reachy, what if another person came along who's only 4 feet tall and your girlfriend would be like, no, this is great. But the other person who's 4 feet tall,
totally,
completely disagrees. Or what if someone's 7.5 feet tall? So when you start entering this in, it's you don't know where to make the cutoff. But I will say that I wrote in my start notes, what's better, sit, stand, or jump? How do we think about pad stacking? Do you want to wrap that note up, Tim, and then we can actually go into each attribute? Yeah. I think maybe we'll answer our questions as we do that.
I like what you're saying, where some things can take stars away, just the fact that it is a less access thing, a height would be the most obvious one. But sit starts, jump starts, what if someone is 7'5"? And then comes into the sport and they're have the exact same obsession that, Eric, you have. And he's I'm going to go look for the best. And everyone's I don't know if you can. It's let's live in these constraints, right? Maybe a lot of boulders out there have a fair amount of constraints for a lot of people and more people can access them. But there are definitely specific boulders that some people just cannot try with the same experience, and maybe they kind of note that in their own experience. But, I think that's a better way to approach that. But, maybe some short person who's, sending every boulder in the world will come and tell us differently. We'll hear it then. Eric, how tall are you, by the way? Because you're not a short guy.
Almost 5'10".
Yeah, okay.
I'm 5'9¾", and I round up on dating apps.
Smart.
Perfect.
Okay, so that seems like you're, somewhat of an average climber size. Well, that's another topic we can get into later. But you have six, currently your system for figuring out the star quality of a climb has six different attributes. I think we've gone over them. I forgive me if I'm doing them in an order that doesn't say the importance, but we have the line. We have the start, the rock, the landing, the height, and the setting. And I think we've narrowed into why those are the six currently. We've kind of talked about movement and different things. So let's go into what earns a climb a star or not. And maybe we should start with the one that you currently think is the highest quality. You said rock. And you know, why does rock quality even matter? And, you know, yeah, well, why start there? What, why is that number one? Now, I know we kind of got into it, but let's go back and rehash it.
Yeah. And that's kind of the question I was asking myself the other night when I started delving into these a little bit more. I think fundamentally it's like the surface in which you are engaging with, and it's like pretty fundamental to all the other, or many of the other attributes. And so it's just, I don't know, it just seems pretty important to me.
Does that like also include holds themselves? Like, cause I thought that was pretty important as well. Like the exact holds, like this foothold is, you know, not necessarily just the rock is good, but maybe the specific foothold is like a weird one, or like a really, really cool one, or, you know, like vice versa, or the hands themselves as well. Have you thought about that?
Yeah. So then like within each category, I started thinking, okay, let's go from like the physical to the experiential. And then I started asking myself, like, should sharpness even be included in the quality of a rock score? Like, sharpness is such a personal experiential thing.
Yeah. So I aggressively shook my head. Because yeah, I just think it's experiential. And it's like, think about Bishop when things feel sharp and all of a sudden you have really good skin. You're like, oh yeah, this is like the right kind of sharp. It really grabs me now. So, sorry, but I interrupted, Eric.
Yeah.
Experiential.
No, yeah. So like, that's something I was going back and forth with. Like, should that even be included? Cause you can have amazing, fantastic rock that's too sharp for any human to climb. Like they just literally slice through all their fingers, you know? And
that's
so
that's a
good
point.
That if you like, yeah. So I think if you were to like stack rank the qualities of rock, it would be like, number one is like, how strong is the rock? Number two would probably be like, is it altered in any way? Like, has it been broken or glued? Has it broken previously? Is it sharp? And then like, lastly, it would be kind of comfortability, like, which is even more subjective than sharpness, I would argue.
So when I saw,
you know, somebody's like, oh, this hole's tweaky or whatever.
Yeah. So when I saw this, this attribute, what it made me think of was I thought it was there because of, permanence, like this idea that the climb would be bullet hard and what was there now is what will be there for future generations. And maybe it won't get polished. You know, and I guess there's an element of it's nice when things are safe too, just that you don't think you're going to blow off a flake. And so I guess I thought of it really differently. And yeah, I guess it did that factor in it. Cause I personally, when my experience on climbing, this is like my, a hot take again for me is I actually like don't care about rock quality as much as other people. Maybe it's cause I'm lighter than a lot of climbers. And so I don't rip off holds. Like I don't care. Like, I feel like my experience on the climb has nothing to do with how friable a climb is unless it feels dangerous. But then it bums me out when a climb breaks and it's like, oh, remember that cool climb that you always wanted to do that you've been, you know, watching videos for 10 years. And then you finally like flew to go do it. And now it's doesn't exist anymore, really. And it's, you know, and now it's just this cruxy, awful climb or something. Like that bums me out. So yeah, that's how I thought rock quality mattered, but it's interesting to hear, you know, what you were saying.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of consider longevity in that first bullet of just like overall rock strength, you know, and, I think that we should judge climbs in the state that they are currently in. But it's interesting to note that a climb like the Shield, for instance, on that really bullet Southern Sandstone is not polished whatsoever, despite so much traffic. And then you might find other classic problems on different rock types that are just completely destroyed now from polish. So.
Yeah, that's why I'm kind of personally like wrestling with this too. I have similar like thought process to Josh, where like my personal experiences in rock climbing, like I tend to like not care. Like I notice when rock is like shittier rock or like chossier rock for sure, like, you know, more crumbly or like more prone to grease. And like, yeah, the Southern Sandstone is ridiculous to me. Like, you know, because maybe those things wouldn't necessarily be considered, you know, the attributes of rock quality at the highest part of the list, but it's some of the most fun rock I've ever grabbed. Like some of, you know, just random features in Chattanooga or, you know, horse pens, just grabbing that is some of the most enjoyable experiences I've ever had grabbing rock, period. You know, like regardless of the rock, like I'll just be sitting around watching people and just like touching rock next to me, be like, this is the best rock I've ever touched. Like this is what I want to grab all of the time, you know? And like Yosemite granite, it's like similar to that, where I'm like grabbing stuff and like, it doesn't matter if it's a rock climb or not, if it's sharp or whatever. I'm just like, whoa, like this rock itself is amazing. And that's kind of what I feel when I'm rock climbing. So it is interesting to hear like all these objective factors. And I'm curious, like, do you, when you're, you know, in this kind of mission mode where you're going for like quest for the best and you're like, okay, I'm going to try this boulder specifically. Do you have opinions that like clash often with like, you know, first of all, the skill that you have, but also like other people's recommendations for you, where I'm sure a lot of these climbs you're going based on history or recommendations or what other people say. And maybe you have your own experience. Like, do you often find that your subjective skill clashes with the objective skill?
Yeah, I think like I have to put my bias aside, which is really hard for me. And initially, like when I started making lists on my phone and everything, when I was much younger, it was just like a list, like Josh had maybe alluded to earlier, that's things that I want to do. And so it was like a bunch of squeeze boulders, but I'm trying not to take that into account so much. And it becomes really clear on this website, which has, you know, a check or an X for each quality. Like you just drag and drop the best ones to the top. And if they don't have good rock or good line or whatever, you drag them down. And it's like really crazy watching as I work on it and reorder stuff, how much has changed from the list that I had created that I thought was being objective, you know, in the last few years or whatever, and seeing climbs that every single person would be like, yes, that's a top five climb, just like drop to the, you know, the 80s or whatever.
That's really so leads me into some good questions from our friend, Will Englin. He wrote kind of along these lines, how much does the quality of the boulder affect your experience on it? I think that's like a really interesting question. You know, is it related at all to the experience? And this is like for you, Eric, like for you specifically.
Yeah, I would say it's completely unrelated. And that's kind of the beautiful thing of climbing is we all like make our own experiences, and it's all about the mentality you bring to a climb and the people you're with and everything like that. And as I mentioned earlier, like there's some boulders on the list that I've done that are objectively great boulders, like TrackMan in Arkansas comes to mind, because it was like fourth day on or something. I was like, oh, I could do one more day in Arkansas before I drive back. Like maybe I can do one more top 100 boulder. And it was bad conditions, like bad skin. I think it was like 75 degrees outside and I did it, but like I didn't have enough pads. Like I missed the pads and busted myself one time, and just like I was hurting my finger. I had like a pulley tweak and was like actively making it worse, but I wanted to do it so bad. So I didn't come back and ultimately just had a bad time. And it's like not a fond memory for me. And on the other side, I've had incredible, incredible memories on like the worst possible boulders you could imagine times.
Dude, so that's so cool. His two follow-up questions were there good boulders you don't actually like? And then are there bad boulders you love? And I just want to hear what some of those bad boulders, low star rating boulders is the one that comes to mind where you just had like amazing time and you love, even though it's dumpy.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the ones that come to mind for me are things that I grew up climbing on in Maryland or Pennsylvania, where Pennsylvania does have some really great climbing. Maryland, not so much, but like you just make it work and you have fun with what you got. And one that just popped into my brain was this V3. I don't remember the name of it, but we just like found out that it was easier to start in a bat hang because the whole boulder is like 4 feet tall. So we just started in a bat hang and then finished, and it was great. Like we had so much fun that day.
Classic.
Yeah. It's actually cool. Yeah. It's a cool question because it really highlights this thing that like, I think it's really exciting to talk about like, well, what are the best boulder problems? But then you kind of have to like check yourself and realize that like fun and rock climbing and like fun and bouldering for us isn't just based on that. Like it totally is not. Actually is like completely an exclusive experience, like you just said. So I think that's fascinating. That's a cool question.
Yeah.
Good answer.
I love that honesty. It's kind of cool to hear just how quickly you're like, no, it doesn't matter. And I think like I'm obsessed with star quality and seeking out climbs that have, you know, are objectively really amazing. But yeah, the fun part, it's not exactly like, oh, and this was really fun for me. There's just something about the draw to these specific climbs that are beautiful. And I use the term beautiful, and that sounds really subjective. And that's where I like kind of trying to deconstruct and encapsulate what makes me drawn to those ones. But yeah, fun is not exactly, it's one of the reasons why I like just getting better at climbing, is so that you can walk up to something and do it. And it's, I wasn't seeking out fun. It was like, I wanted to climb that one because when I saw it, it was that one. And okay, that brings us back to the attributes. And one thing that the last thing I'll say on rock and rock quality that I find really interesting is it's like, does chipping actually matter? Like everything we've said, now look, do not chip. People do not go out there and chip. It's not okay because you don't know, because you suck and you're weak and someone is stronger. And if it's not someone alive today, there's someone will be in 100 years. So don't chip. But I just find it interesting how objectively, like Etchele is like a really well set boulder. It's kind of low ball and dump. It's like a, you know, you guys know the famous V14 that was, that's manufactured in Colorado. And everything I think about when we talk about rock quality, it's like chipping or gluing. I mean, maybe gluing you could take an issue with, but it just strikes me as interesting that when we're talking about the quality of a climb objectively, like I'm not sure chipping really matters. I don't know if there's anything to say about that other than I find that interesting. Okay, you guys got nothing. Okay, don't chip.
Well, no. Yeah. I got something, I think.
Okay.
Well, one thing I did want to say, just kind of about Will's comment was I do think quality can be like a multiplier. Mm. It's like a multiplier of fun.
That's
like
interesting.
The very, yeah. very best times I think are like when you're with your homies and it's a great day and conditions yeah. are good and you all send and it's like a mega, like that's the best, you know?
Ooh, I like that.
But
that
was good.
Agreed. I love it.
That's yeah. That's just awesome. But I think like, the question of chipping, it comes down to like a purity standpoint. I think like the best boulder ideally will be a very pure boulder that's unaltered by like, it just is that way. It's that strong. And so I think like, I was trying to think, is it worse to have a chipped hold or a glued hold? And I think it's worse to have a chipped hold because a glued hold at least is like preserving something that once was. And like, maybe it wouldn't even have been broken if it hadn't been glued.
Yeah.
Like the start hold of Spectre is glued, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it would have stayed on. Who knows? But the fact that it had to be glued is obviously an indication of quality. And so, yeah. Anyway, like when I think of a perfect boulder, I'm imagining like you walk up and all the holds are completely solid.
Totally.
Yeah, you know, you don't
totally
have to break
agree.
Any troughs. Like it's just bullet.
I'm just picking up the details. I don't disagree at all. One last thing that I was wondering if it's a factor is... with rock is that sometimes climbs just have a hold that is just magically formed and something really interesting, intriguing, and unique. In your quest for the best, you did Wormwood, this cool V9 in Waco that Jason Kale put up. And actually, I think Jason said he thought that was the best climb in Waco, maybe. And it had that interesting feature that's kind of like tufa-esque and I'm trying to think of another climb that has an iconic hold. For some reason, it just escapes me. Maybe you guys can come up with one, but I don't know if that's subjective or if it's objective. It's just cool. Like the worm turns. You mentioned that in that video where it becomes attractive, even though I've never seen the worm turns, but it kind of looks in a cave. It kind of doesn't look incredible, but that feature of like a tufa on sandstone is fascinating to people. And yeah, does that enter into the start quality?
Yeah, I don't think it does, but like Brian Nugent and I did a lot of work on the list originally, and we were kind of thinking of it as like a, like uniqueness is like a bonus point or like a tiebreaker or something. Cause everyone loves a unique move or hold or
totally.
Factor in a problem for sure. It's everyone loves it. It's undeniable.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the uniqueness is super, super awesome. I think like I went to Horse Pens for like a day and I thought all these crazy, like, shell-like features that I was grabbing was like the most unique, one of the more unique climbing experiences I've had on rock. And I just thought that was fascinating where I was like, man, like I want to run into something like this so much more often than I do in my climbing life. But, you know, I think I climbed this one boulder. We had just done like Millipede and what's Bumboy. We had just like been in that region and the day was over. And the very last climb that I did to put on my list was 5-0, which is this like V9 kind of traverse thing, and then you get to this like mantle sequence on these like very similar to Bumboy, where these like big, you're grabbing these big shells, but they're way worse and they're like way wider. Have you done 5-0, Eric or Josh? Have you done 5.0?
I've seen it. I don't think I actually climbed it, but one day I was at HP 40.
5.0 is phenomenal. It's so cool. Like how you grab the whole hold, like it was one of the climbing experiences that I've had in a long time where I like had to do something completely unique to get up the climb. And that could have just been because I was fried and tired from like an 8-hour day. But, you know, I thought that was an interesting experience that I had. I like find that unique rock and like unique moves, unique settings, like make me do unique things in climbing. And I thought that was just like fascinating. Sorry, nothing to do with what you're just talking about. I just thought that was fascinating.
Okay.
This is making me like reminisce. Sorry, this is making me reminisce on like all the climbing experiences that I've had too, like over my entire like life. And I'm just like, wow, this is so cool. Like that we, you know, as a kid, I was just doing this because, you know, it's just like the most fun thing ever. But like, as you become a little bit more refined and have people like Eric who are like obsessed and just like make lists like this, you're like, yeah, this is like what I love. Like, this is sick. This is so cool.
I just love the idea of trying to figure out something to chase after in climbing, like, you know, deciding what is meaningful to you. And like you said, it's not always just about fun. Like that could be a different list. And I do think it's more subjective, but I don't know. That's why I love digging into these details. And this is a specific type of pursuit. And so, let's keep going. I think we checked the rock attribute. I think I thoroughly poked at the rock attribute. What do you think is the next most important one? Or I won't hold you to that in the long run, because in some ways that's even subjective, is what's the most important, you know, attribute, but which one do you want to tackle next?
Yeah. And I don't know the like true order, if there even is a true order, but for me, the next thing I had on my list was line.
Can you maybe just
describe the line? Yeah. So the line, like really the name of the game here is like the path of least resistance. And so in my mind, like the perfect boulder, that's the only way up. And, you know, when you have like Gumbies coming up and they're like, you know, you can just walk around the back. Well, like they have a pretty good point, and it kind of does make the objective, kind of foolish. And so there's not many examples of this. I would say Airwolf is one of them, or great, Best in Show. In Indian Creek, like the easiest way up is to climb Airwolf, I think. And then you jump off onto like an adjacent rock. And that's pretty cool to me. That's like, it gives it some sort of purpose. Like you're trying to summit this boulder and that's the only way. Totally. And so in my mind, there's the best line is just one line on an entire boulder, and that's the easiest way up.
Ooh,
that's fantastic.
That's good.
Mention, I will bring up like another part of this like line concept, because I also watched White Lines, which is this V8 in Tahoe. And you kind of mentioned at the very end of the video, you were like, you could easily go, you know, from here this way, right, left, you can exit this way. Like you can grab these holds. Like that is clearly, and I remember doing White Lines like 8 years ago, and I was like, fun V8, it's super hard, like literally the hardest V8 I've ever done. But like, you know, at that time, and I still think it's one of the harder V8s that I'd done at that, you know, like still. But I just remember like not thinking about those things. Like I didn't really consider it necessarily, but now that I look at it, I'm like, that is horrendous. Like you point out all these holds and I was like, what the hell? Like you literally are, there's like, you're avoiding all of these different things just because this is what, I don't know. But yeah, that was like a pretty like striking thing. And I mean, you go to like, there's like lines like, the Grandpa Peabody face, where there's like, you know, 5 or 6 different lines on one face. And luckily they don't really like go into each other or anything like that. And that makes it a good line, you know, but like they're definitely like objectively bad lines and good lines. And that's an interesting thought.
Yeah. I just love that definition in general of saying that the ideal way is the easiest way up. And it kind of makes me think of people doing something like Mount Everest, where the goal is to get to the top. It started out as how do I get to the top of that? Not, you know, up that sweet face. It was just, no, I want to get the top. What's the path of least resistance? And so I think that's a really good answer. And boy, is it rare. I actually wasn't even sure if there was one. Like it seems rare that the only way up a rock is through technical rock climbing. Like that seems surprisingly rare. And that's cool. Airwolf, I remember seeing video of that, and just that is definitely on the life list. So one thing is when we talk about line, we talk about how we get up the boulder. And I think we would all agree that we seem to rate climbs that are direct, aka straight up, less deviation to the left and the right, not so traversing, as higher. But it's kind of like, why is that? Like, why is it better when something goes straight up versus traversing? And I think one of the more interesting examples is something like Slash Face that is pretty classic and pretty highly regarded as an incredible climb, but it's more traversing than it is straight up. And why does that take away points? Do you have any thoughts on that, Eric?
Yeah, I think there's a few things here. And one that comes to mind is that, like, we would all probably agree that a rising traverse is nicer than just a traverse. And I think part of that kind of delves into the start hold conversation. But one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is, like, if you can reach subsequent holds beyond the start hold on a problem, then, like, all of a sudden that becomes more contrived. So back to this perfect boulder, like, a perfect start, you can't reach any subsequent holds. You have to start on that start hold. And that's the only way to get the top. And I think with a traverse, like, you can pull on anywhere, which I think makes it worse. And then there's something about how grandiose it is to get high off the ground, I think. And maybe it becomes more experiential when we talk about, like, the feeling or the sensation of going up versus sideways. But yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the true answer.
This is a general question for all of this, but it makes me wonder how technology fits into the system, because you're talking about, I like what you said around stand starts and being only able to feel those boulders feel those holds. And then it makes me think about wrapping down something and, feeling holds or rehearsing things. I know now we're starting to talk about style, but there's a general idea there around technology and how that affects the star system, because I think it comes out more when we talk about height, which is somehow correlated to line as well, and that grandiosity. And, if you have, I don't know, some kind of crash pad that lets you fall from 40 feet, does that change what kind of star rate? Me and Jamie were joking about calling it star deflation. How do things change over time when you add new boulders, you have new technology that allows different things? If you bring ladders now out and you can feel the holds up high versus when you only could do a kind of ground up ascent, I'm getting into the weeds here, but I love just
this
trying
is
to
so fascinating.
Piece it apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have really, like, very, I think, controversial thoughts with all of this type of stuff. I will say, I guess, like, a more important caveat is I'm much more like, I was texting Josh about this the other night, and I was like, I'm much more like an Andra type climber, where I'm very performance and movement focused in my climbing. So, like, I come up with, to these challenges, and I'm like, that's fascinating. Like, it's cool that people have so much, importance on these things. And then I have a personal draw to specific things, and I kind of go into that because it really sits to line. But I only have a personal draw to line when it matters. And I'll kind of go into that as well, because otherwise I kind of focus on, like, the experience. For example, like, Refuge is, like, my home gym now. This is, like, a gym in, southern Las Vegas. And it's, it's, like, a lot of the strong climbers, like, use this gym as, like, the hub in this area. But it's only, like, one of three gyms in Vegas. Anyway, Refuge has this interesting thing where some of the climbs top on a hold and some of the climbs top on the top of the wall. But there was an interesting thing where, like, obviously some of the last movements on the walls would, like, be skippable. But also some of the last movements of this gym would be the hardest moves on the climb. And in the beginning, Michaela and I would just, like, climb whatever and just, like, jump to the top on, like, almost all the climbs. And then literally, like, the next week, the owner of the gym was just talking to me about, like, their team. And he was like, yeah, we just have a rule on team that you have to grab every finish, every hold, to consider it ascent. It's just an arbitrary rule that we follow. And I was like, that's interesting, because it's not an arbitrary rule that you follow. It's how you set, right? And you're obviously preserving an experience that is important to you guys, that, like, you have to do all the movements to consider it a rock climb. And I think, like, that is similar to, like, the experience that we try to preserve in terms of, like when you're talking about, going up, or, like, a rising traverse being, almost, like, more, like, grandiose, or, like, more than just a lateral traverse. I think the reason for that is because we're preserving the experience of rock climbing actually is. And, like, traverses are just kind of, like, dinky. I think for me, that's what drop-offs are like as well. Like, I really don't like dropping off because summiting a boulder is like very, very core to what climbing is, period. And I think like I want to preserve that experience. And then going into like, those are all like just thoughts that I had when it comes to these types of things. But, and then I also don't have like extreme, constraints, like when I'm like making rules about my own climbing. But I will say that style and like line is really important when it comes for me to like highballing. I just thought about this because Josh was talking about ladders and like wrapping down things. And I do think that like at a certain point, just the fact that we are climbing like tall things, I think is like a big part of the point of the line. And I don't know, I just found it interesting. I don't know if Eric has thoughts about this because I know Eric, you like highballing as well. And I was also curious like why you like highballing and, you know, if that's, is it more towards like this objective scale of like they're just better boulders this way, or is it like an experience? Because I think those all kind of tie in together of like why we think they're the best. I don't know if that kind of like, you know, gets you thinking about that. That was a lot of thoughts.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that was a lot. So much to respond to. I do love highballs so much, but I think like for the objectivity of the list, like the tallest boulders are probably not better necessarily. I think there's like a sweet spot of probably like 15 to 20 feet or something along those lines. But I mean, and Josh, to your question about technology and wrapping and everything, there is like, I think this becomes more about style and less about the boulder. Like for a long time, I did everything ground up and it wasn't like easier. It was a lot scarier, but like that was the style I enjoyed climbing highballs. And only more recently, as I'm getting a little older and probably wiser, have I started wrapping things more often. But I still do things every once in a while ground up just for that experience. And I also, when developing, sometimes enjoy developing a boulder ground up because that takes me back to kind of my roots in Maryland and Pennsylvania. Like the climbing scene there is so much different and so much less advanced than out west, and so like no one wrapped down boulders, like that was unheard of. No one used stick brushes, so like so much of climbing was like get one hold higher, like paw at moss, like try and find a hold or whatever. And so sometimes for fun I will just develop boulders in that style, and then I'll usually go back and wrap down it and clean it so everyone else can have a better experience. But yeah, I think that's all like the style of what you're climbing and the experience of what you're having, and less about the boulder problem itself.
Yeah, like I like that the idea of technology is not about the boulder, right? So you're saying that whenever I talk about ladders or wrapping, it kind of, that's not the boulder. That's my approach. And yeah, we could, you know, consider that style. I guess where I think it comes into play is that technology perhaps opens up things that weren't available before. And so something like landing, you know, Jason Kale's done a lot of stuff with nets in Waco, and yeah, it's just kind of an interesting idea. I was thinking about Jason and something like evolution when he did it, it's right on the edge of what was possible, especially with pad technology. My hunch is he didn't have triple stacked, sea of foam. I mean, I'm sure he had foam, but not as much as we probably do nowadays. And so it's just an interesting idea of what happens when we find bigger boulders and we are able to do them safely. But then it also seems ridiculous to say, well, El Cap is a boulder and, you know, Alex Hunnell just did it in a good style. And so, you know, there's no total perfect answer here. It's just something that's fun to think about what makes a line good. Why do we like going up? Yeah, how do these things change over time? Because ideally, if we're just talking about the boulder in itself, it doesn't matter exactly what happens later, but it kind of does when we talk about height. So I don't know. Just my thoughts on it.
Yeah. Well, I think that when I'm judging a boulder's quality, I'm trying to judge it. Like if we're talking about landing, I'm trying to judge the landing with no safety implements. Because like obviously you can get more pads always. You can get a net. You can like kind of change this, but if we're going for purity of experience, which is I think what we're kind of getting at with like line of the easiest way up, it's just like the only way, then the purest experience would be like no crash pads, no climbing shoes. And so I think like the best landing is flat. And they talked about this on the Careless Talk podcast, the Sam and Aiden Roberts' podcast, they have this like desert island boulder thing, and they ask all their guests to choose their five desert island boulders. And like a factor in that is that it's a sand landing. So like you don't need crash pads. It's just like great. You can just climb it pure style. So I think the best landings are like in a grassy field or a sandy beach or something that can absorb your fall. And like you can, in theory, do it in the most pure way.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I think I just brought it up because I personally, because this is such an objective conversation, like we're dissecting a scale and a definition of these things that are so objective, reflecting on my own experience. I think personally, when I think about line, I only consider these things really like as important to me when I'm doing highball boulders.
Okay, so bullet rock, straight up line on a boulder with that, where that's literally the easiest line. Although, God, that does bug me. Sorry, I thought we were going to go past it. I totally agree with that. But it is interesting how then it almost feels like if other climbs get established, even if they're more difficult, it actually does feel like it takes away from that one singular line.
Totally.
But then I guess I would argue that in some way, in some history, there will always be other lines on that boulder. We may not be able to climb them yet, but, you know, just for argument's sake, in some ways, everything is climbable in the future. I can see you squinting there and disagreeing. So
I disagree.
Please,
there's
please.
Just like blank glass walls that no one will ever climb for sure.
Maybe I'm optimistic. And we don't know what technology allows later. That's one of the reasons why I'm super anti-chipping, is I can imagine people, you know, creating weird, you know, it's like the fingertip rubber stuff that I remember. Was that Mad Rock trying to, like, we don't know what comes in the future. But okay. I not only am I in the weeds, I'm like deep in the weeds here. Okay. So bullet rock, no glue, didn't get chipped straight up because, it's just there's a, I don't know. I mean, we're fighting against gravity and I like that idea too of not being able to hold, grab all the holds. There's something that, I don't know why that, God, that's an ineffable thing. I really agree with that idea of not being able to grab the holds.
For sure.
So what attribute do you want to add to that list next?
Sure. We can go to start.
Okay. What?
I think then.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think it just becomes important to think about like, why is a starting position important? And when I was thinking about this the other day, I'm not, Dave, who you mentioned earlier, my coworker, like he's all about ChatGPT. Like I feel like all the boomers are into it and I'm like not into it, but I did ask ChatGPT. I was like, why is the start important? And like, why is the start important in sports and things like that? And, you know, it basically said that it's, you know, important for everyone to have the same experience and it's, like a standardized thing that everyone can test themselves on. And I agree with all of that. And I think the best start is like extremely clear. There's no ambiguity or potential for confusion. Like there's a number of, I mean, there's so many climbs out there where one person starts one way, someone else starts another way. It should be like, if you were the first person to walk up and there's no chalk on the boulder, every single person would choose to start in the same place. And there's not any other options. There's no like little footholds that you could do a low start on. There's not holds out left. That's so cool. Then everyone can have the same exact experience, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever heard the term, shelling point, where people all shelling point is this idea of where people just naturally congregate. Like the thing would be if you said, meet me in New York City. I think the argument is that everyone would go to like Times Square or something like that. That would be, it's like New York City. Okay. Times Square. But first, I just want to really make sure there's no ambiguity that you, called out Mr. David Gurman as a boomer, your boss, co-founder of Kaya,
yes,
who you work for. So yeah, I don't know if he's a boomer, but let's hear it, Dave. Are you a boomer or not? Anyways, who said a bunch of very nice things about you, Erica, by the way, just want to put that out there. So you return the favor by by calling his age out. I love that. I like this. I put the term shelling point out there. That's where you're going to start because that's the hold. That's the big hold. And it makes me think about sit starts, stand starts, and jump starts. And I wanted to argue, although this maybe brings in a factor of reach and stuff, that jump starts are just the coolest, most badass, best way to start a climb. And one of my first really experiences with what I would call a 5 or even 6-star boulder, and I have not done this boulder, unfortunately, is King Air. And I remember stumbling upon King Air, which is this giant V10 in Yosemite. And I didn't know anything about it, or I maybe had like heard about it. And you just see this kind of juggish start, and it's up high, and you have to jump and grab it. And I just was, it's just so cool. It's this giant, massive boulder. And the way you even get on it is to jump and grab the beginning hold. And so, yeah, just thinking about, I think you made a really good argument about just how to think about, like, conceptually where the start is. But yeah, it doesn't matter if it's a sit or a stand or a jump, or is there ever a sit start that people would automatically have a shelling point towards? Probably not, but I don't know.
I think if the
jug is big enough, there would be. And I think that like size and obviousness of the hold is more important almost than starting height. Because like you look at a climb like King Air, and there's a lot of jump starts on the list, like Iron Resolution, Kintsugi. And I think they're on the list because like the fact that it starts on a big honker jug is more important than the fact that it's a jump start. But if you were jump starting to like an obvious hold, that would like be kind of lame. And so same deal with a sit. Like I think you can have like a super obvious sit start jug. But I think a stand is the ideal.
Yeah. I think the thing that gets me the most about this like start concept is how many bad starts. Like I'm just thinking through like all these boulders that I've done or been to, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, yeah, there's a lot of bad starts. Like I think the conversation I got into that was like kind of controversial was I was talking to somebody about Trieste, and like I had been trying just Trieste, the stand start, but it was put up as a stand start. It was put up by Paul Robinson as, you know, this like kind of arbitrary start. Just didn't make really much sense. But like when you're actually climbing it, it makes a lot of sense, right? Where it's like this left-handed hold is like kind of weird and it's small. It's like one of the smaller holds on the entire climb. And the right hand is like pretty much like, it's just an intermediate, it seems like. It's like not even, and then you kind of do a move into like the position that maybe even seems more like the start hold. But, you know, it's weird because it's like more about the position and the climb. But then I had a conversation with somebody who was like, the sit start is like just the climb because there's just, you know, there's no other start other than it. And I was like, that's so fascinating to me that like we can take away, you know, and I kind of agree, like I kind of agree. But then also I'm like, I just honor Paul and like him doing this climb first. And I'm like, it's a climb because he did it first. Right. So it's like there's this historical aspect where I'm like, he said it was a climb. He did the climb first. And like, that's the climb. But then there's this like literal objective, like that's even a start. Like if you can start from this obvious platform jug, like shouldn't we? Obviously that start, you know, specifically in that rock climb, like maybe that climbing itself is not that great, you know, because you're like dabbing on this rock underneath the wall that's like kind of chossy and it's, you know, chipping away every time. You're grabbing this hold that's like a dog shit crimp, and then you have this like really weird, you know, Ethan like hurt his knee on this move, I think. And yeah, I just think that was like a fascinating conversation. You have like Wet Dream, which I think is like objectively one of the best boulders, you know, ever in that great range. But then like you go to the start area and there's like so many different holds and like different footholds and whatnot. It's so weird. And then you have Wet Dream Right that just like starts on these other strange crimps. And so I think it's just fascinating where it's like, oh yeah, there are these like amazing boulders, but we don't think about the start that much. And then you kind of talked about Critically Acclaimed and, you know, showed the star hold like, yeah, perfect, like literally a perfect star hold. And then you just mentioned traverses, which I think was fascinating, where you're talking about the contrivance of traverses where you can just literally start wherever you want. But then there are obvious traverses that start on really, like Ironman traverse is a pretty perfect traverse because literally the holds get smaller and smaller as you go. And the biggest hold is the one you start on. And it's at the most left part of this wall that you go from left to right. That's like a perfect traverse as far as traverses go. But yeah, it's just fascinating that like starts actually do matter so, so much. I never really thought about it until you kind of mentioned it.
Yeah, it matters a lot. And the best ones don't have any ambiguity, like,
yeah,
at all. And it's an interesting discussion that I don't have an answer for that I've had with people of like, should we rewrite history in that way? Like, should Trieste just start from the ground? Like, and there's plenty of boulders. There's boulders that I have done like the second ascent of and started higher or lower or whatever than the first ascent and just been like, whatever, like that's better. And like kind of pseudo rewrote history in that way. Yeah. And then there's other boulders where I've like been like, oh, this start sucks, but I'm going to respect what the first ascensionist did.
Totally.
And so, yeah, I think it's case dependent and there's not really a right or wrong answer, but it is interesting to talk about.
That's why I brought it up, because I think it is really like case dependent.
Yeah. I like what you're saying, Tim. And I think that it's almost like those are different discussions from maybe the star rating, where I would argue, if I was in Eric's shoes, I would say that, well, that makes Trieste stand, or whatever you want to call it, that like docks a star. You know, you're saying like, yeah, sure, that was a climb. You know, Paul did, but you know, let's just acknowledge that, Trieste Sid or whatever, you know, low is the more obvious line. It makes me think of, I did, Tequila Sunrise, which, is a sit start, and it got put up holding these two Wacos as your left and right hand. And then someone came along and did it just from the right Waco, which is pretty juggy. And I say it does seem more obvious to start there, but I don't know how long after I did it, after it got put up, but long enough or not long enough that it was kind of established there. And that's like, so did I do it? Did I not do it? But I'll tell you what I heard from this conversation right here. That's very clear. Is sit starts suck. That's just, I hate sit starts. I to me, they make bouldering feel lame, in my opinion. Like, it's the reasons why I like something. It's one of the reasons why I like high balls. When I think of good boulders, is this, it's impressive. It's scary. It's for real. And I don't like low ball butt draggers, because I feel like, just what am I doing? Like, what am I doing? Like, I'm trying not to dab on the pad. You know, oh, my foot. Like, I think if dabbing is a possibility, that automatically takes away stars. Because, yeah, if you can dab, it just sucks, in my opinion. And so
there's the gyms rant. In the Bay Area, for some reason, have so many like horrendous sit start walls, like the PG Sunnyvale Cave on the right side. There's like, I kind of just grew up with this, so I never really had beef with it going outside. But like, yeah, and like, we always used to make spray wall climbs and stuff. So like, starting on two arbitrary holds that are facing the wrong way, going to another move, also didn't matter to me. But it seems like preserving this in outdoor climbing makes so much more sense.
Okay, we should be passing this off to Eric. But the last thing I'll say is just, it's like, I grew up sport climbing, and sport climbing, it's like you just start. Right. You're just like, get on the wall and go. And I just hated this, like, rules about being in the dirt and starting here. It just made it feel so lame. Like, I don't like the rules. I'm shout out to Jason Kale for just, I just want to do it. And so I love that about King Air. It was the first jump start I'd ever seen. And it just felt like, okay, here we go. Like, off to the races with already at 10 feet tall, and there was no ambiguity in anyone. Already felt badass by launching yourself into the air and starting like that, swinging around. So sit starts suck, but maybe jump starts are too reachy. And the last one I'll think about with jump starts is, do you know what the wizard is, Eric? Have you seen the wizard in Yosemite?
No, I don't think so.
Tim, do you know about it? It's a V10 that I don't know how many people have done it, very few. And you have to run and jump from a boulder, like off to the side.
Old Dean Potter?
Dean Potter.
Okay. Yeah.
Just like, you think about like obvious starting holds and jump starts. That's the one that comes to mind. You can kind of not really do a crazy wild jump. I was never able to latch the starting hold. It's hard, man. I don't know how many people have done it, but all right. Starting holds, shelling point, one hand or two doesn't seem to matter. Sit starts suck. Jump starts maybe are exclusive, or, you know, make it exclusionary. So maybe they're not as good. But I would just argue you could stack some pads, but I guess stand starts ideal, you said, Eric?
I think so. I mean, like, you see people stacking pads or stacking rocks under things like Evolution or any of these boulders. And like, that, I think, kind of takes away from the experience a little bit. You said one hand or two doesn't matter. So what do you mean by that?
Oh, I just made that up as I was talking to you, because that was one of my questions. But it seemed to me like, I love this idea. I keep using the term shelling point, because it's just, when you described it to me, it just made so much sense, where it's just obvious. There's no ambiguity, because we all just end up there, and that's what it would be. So if you have two hands. I mean, I guess one hand or a one jug would be a better obvious thing. But if it is obvious also that it's two hands, like it's just two side poles that are the perfect size that are opposing right in front of you, it kind of still seems like a similar concept, like a first principles concept. But do you disagree there?
I kind of think a two-handed jug is like the ideal, because what you find sometimes is even if there are like two obvious start hands, like someone could start with just one of them and pull off the ground, or they could just like hold their hand against the wall or something like that. Or like put it on a little foothold or something. So I think like a two-handed jug is really nice. And then like within that, even a two-handed hold that like doesn't even have room for more than two hands, because then there's even that ambiguity of like, where on this jug do you start? Yeah. You know what I mean?
I really wish Spectre, I feel like Spectre was like specifically glued and broken, so it wasn't going to get the perfect boulder, because it's just like, it is like, it's such a perfect boulder. Like it's just a perfect starting height, perfect starting jug, perfect starting feet, you know, perfect line, you know, like a hard top out. Maybe the top out could be better, but like otherwise a pretty perfect climb. And then I found out it was glued like many, many years later. No way, dude. Like that's terrible. That's awful. But like, yeah, that would be the most obvious perfect boulder.
Let's use Spectre to use this star rating. Is Spectre on your, I'm going to look at your website. Did you add Spectre? How many stars would you give Spectre? Let's use it as the example.
Yeah, Spectre's on there. And I think it's like, I think the only thing that I really took off a whole like full point for was rock because of the gluing. Mm-hmm. And like, I haven't climbed on it, but like, seems like somewhat friable up top. I'm sure like other shit is broken in the course of its history.
Break a foothold off.
You took out one. And then like, it kind of,
oh, so I actually haven't gone through and like done all the setting ones yet, because it feels like so weird to me, like, because setting's so ambiguous and like so many places are in like, so many boulders are in beautiful places, but it's like, does that checkbox only get ticked if it's like insanely beautiful, you know? And then how do you qualify that? And
so I haven't gone through that yet,
but
do you have a scale for these things? I
started to make the scale for like each of them, except for I haven't gone through scenery yet. And then line is like, it almost, you know, I still gave it the check, but there are like multiple exits that you can take on that boulder. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm Tim, my Spectre is amazing, but I don't know why. I never thought Spectre was as cool as some of the other ones in Bishop. Like it's amazing, but you know, it seems kind of low, even though it's a big, tall boulder. I don't like when boulders are lopsided like that, where it's cool when like the climbing brings you actually to the summit instead of like you climb and then you climb, you know, a long time to get to the summit. That kind of bothered me, but
I think Spectre has specific like attributes taken away, but I will say that is like, I think I value specific attributes. That's why I asked about a scale, because I value like specific attributes just smashing the scale, you know, more than like meeting all of the scale requirements. That's actually an interesting point. Do you have boulders that are
I want to ask if it's like how it's binary. Like, yeah, you just have either, it's like either has a star or it doesn't. But the last thing I'll say on Spectre is the thing I just don't really like about Spectre is I haven't done it. And you know, it just,
I was gonna say, I was like, that's no, we can't shit on Spectre. You guys have to go and do it.
Okay.
This boulder I've spent probably the most time on, in my life, but it's definitely like, which is like so sad because it's three moves basically. But it's just like, for me, it's so special.
Well, so yeah, so
I can't shit talk it.
What's the reasoning, or do you think this will change over time between just having things be binary when it comes to a star rate, attribute getting a star or not?
I think it's got to change and like adapt, because that's the problem I'm running into as I'm scoring these climbs, is things where it's like, well, the line, like it does have two exits or whatever, but like it's still really good. And there's just like all this ambiguity. And I think maybe if I had more of like a STEM background or was more interested in statistics or mathematics, I could like come up with a better system, and maybe someone else out there will get psyched and do that. But for me, it's like, I'm just kind of like giving my best guess on a lot of them. And if people want to disagree, like that's cool. And we can discuss it and maybe I'll change my mind or change their mind. But yeah, right now it's not a perfect system by any means.
Okay, good stuff. I think we figured out, we've now figured out rock, line, and start. What comes next on your list?
Height and then landing, which are kind of intertwined, I think. Well, I guess, so height, what I was thinking about is like, why is the height important? Like, and what about it is important? Is it the safety? If it is the safety, like that's greatly impacted by the landing, because you can have a 10-foot tall boulder with a horrible landing that's super dangerous, or you could have like a 40-foot boulder with a great landing that's super safe. And so they're kind of intertwined. And if we are talking about height in terms of safety, then I think like you don't want it to be, I guess we're talking about safety in terms of purely safety. There's nothing wrong with it being a 5-foot tall boulder, but there is something wrong with it being like 30 feet. And so I think like 10 to 20, maybe 25 feet is a nice middle ground for a boulder problem. But then you're also balancing safety with like time on the wall, engagement, exposure. But those are becoming a little bit more subjective and experiential, I would say.
Yeah, to me,
so this is like a Goldilocks scale. Like you're looking for like the happy medium.
Yeah, I guess that's how I've been thinking about it.
Yeah, to me, the two issues there is that technology does change the experience over time, and I use Jason as an example where what becomes just the regular approach for climbing with crash pads changes what was previously dangerous before. So I just, yeah, it's just an interesting thing to think about. And then I also think that there's a subjectivity thing there where I remember when I did Evolution, I was fucking terrified to fall above the lip. And I see people taking that ride all the time. And I don't know if I was just being a wuss or technology has not changed enough in my time since doing it that it's somehow better crash pads or something. But, you know, maybe just younger kids are willing to take that ride and can survive it more easily with not even a thought. And it almost feels like, you know, there is this upper bounds, though, that I don't think anyone feels comfortable taking the ride off the top of Ambrosia. Like, I don't think there's anyone that would say this is okay. So, I don't know, just some thoughts on that.
And yeah, and then there's also the factor of risk, because you can have a boulder as tall as Ambrosia that's dead easy climbing for the last 20 feet. Mm-hmm. And then it's like not actually so risky, or, you know, the inverse of that.
The top out of Spectre is super, super tricky.
But not where you're gonna die though, or something. You know, like I don't know. Isn't it easier up there?
I don't know. Sorry, that's too deep. I thought I was gonna take it pretty hard if I fell on Spectre at the top. But I did the direct top out. Like if you go right, for sure not. But if you do the direct top out, for sure you're like, dude, this is messed up. It's a messed up highball. Because you're on a bulge and like it feels like you're gonna ride the slab and then flip if you fall. Therefore, you will hit your head if you fall. And then I don't know where the pads were. So the risk felt pretty high to me. But anyway, that's a totally different thing where like, I like what Eric is saying. The style of climbing makes a huge difference because, you know, that involves the risk. Like Evolution is extreme. Like I actually level, like people have asked, like, how do you, you know, what's harder? Like Ambrosia is the hardest grade of the highballs that you're doing. Like in Bishop, it's like, is that the hardest one? I'm like, no, of course not. Too big to flail is like a much, much, much higher level in highball factor, right? Like in terms of risk, like style and like, why it's difficult, it's sustained, it's V10, but it's like, you know, it's like a level 9 out of 10 highball for me. Like it really is like that extreme in terms of that exposure feeling and the risk and like how it feels. But Ambrosia is like a little bit bitier and like, you know, it's weirder movement, but it's like, it's still very controllable. Like I can grab every hold and power through it, you know, regardless of how pumped I am, I can still power through it because it's frictiony. Anyway, that stuff is all also fascinating for height. I'm fascinated with this one because it's for me, like, I'm curious how it falls into the scale for you, you know, like how often you run into that one. Like,
isn't that subjective stuff we're starting to talk about, Eric, where, you know, like the risk at the top of height?
Yeah. Inherently, it's like all pretty subjective, which is the problem with this whole thing. But I think visual impact is like a huge one for height, which I kind of like the way Max describes it, which is very subjective, but he says it'd be hard to argue that a proud pure line of 20 feet is not superior to a similar one of 12 feet. Height adds everything: grandiosity, an intimidation factor, consequences, and you get to climb for longer. Sweet. And
I like that.
I agree with all those things, but it is totally subjective. Like, someone else might feel very differently. But
yeah. At what point does
that's what we're going with, I guess.
Become objective? Yeah. Like, because that's kind of a goal with creating a scale and like a list, is like adding some objectivity. Like, it's nice that Max says it that way, I think, you know, where it's like, it's hard to argue that this is just cooler, better. Like, people would say it's better.
I like that.
But it's still subjective.
Thanks, Max, for summing that up well, because sorry, I didn't mean to try to pin you down. Like, isn't that subjective, where it's like, riskier or not risky up there?
it's all subjective, like through and through.
So, and on that note, for me, when I thought about what gets 5 or 6 stars or whatever, or the way, if you look at my 8A, I kind of have a list of how I rated the climbs. And this was actually when I wrote it, 8A only allowed for 3 stars, but they also allowed for a thumbs up, like a recommended. And basically what it came down to was just, I thought that what makes a climb good is if someone who is a non-climber thought it was cool, like without climbing it, just like you walk up next to it. And it kind of brings me back to climbing as a kid, and you just, you know, stand next to something, you're like, whoa, this is cool. You know, it's like, and just like a good example of what you're talking about with the grandiosity and Max's description is, I like to climb tall, big trees, not, you know, little tiny trees, just because they're cool. And so, you know, talk about subjectivity. That's just the ultimate subjectivity. So, So landing, flat landing, it also made me think of A Wrinkle in Time, which I thought was fascinating. I guess that falls under the unique list. A Wrinkle in Time is that climb in Joe's where, to climb it, or at least as far as I'm aware, that's when it's always climbed.
Oh, it's over the water.
Yeah. When it's frozen. So it's when it's frozen. By the way, great name, whoever, named it that.
That's so cool.
I don't know who did. Was it Paul?
Paul Robinson.
Paul. Yeah. Go Paul.
I believe so.
So yeah, flat landing. I mean, we kind of, touched on this with the height and, the desert island boulders and, making it safer, but anything else we want to tackle with landing, or should we just check that off as intertwined with height?
I think we covered it fairly well. I kind of started to try and do like this ranking of like from perfect to bad or horrible, and horrible as being like a drop off into spikes, and perfect is like that flat landing we talked about. And then I think you can kind of like decide if it's like gets the star or not, maybe through that. But then, yeah, with snow or water, things like that, I think it should be judged as like the state in which it is in without the snow or the ice or whatever. Let me look at my notes. How about anything else on that?
Yeah. How about drawing of three? We were texting about drawing of three, because I remember seeing drawing of three and it looked tall and impressive. And then when I did it, we had dug it out of the snow. And it just made me think, like, what am I doing here? I'm taking this amazing, majestic kind of, you know, prow, and it's just almost a butt dragger. I mean, I had a blast doing it, but it kind of made me take a step back, and I was like, I climbed these boulders for a specific reason in this condition that I climbed in. Did I really climb it? Like, did I get that? Did I do drawing of three, or did I, you know, cheat myself out of experience that I really wanted to have.
Is that what you're saying, by the way, Eric, that actually does take away, or we shouldn't consider that experience?
I just think it should be judged as like the state it's in with no snow. So like drawing over the three, for example, is like a flat landing without the snow, but like Sunseeker is like unclimbable and dangerous without the snow. But I think, I don't know. I just love a really good flat landing, and the thing is, landings like can be altered and are constantly being altered. And anyone who's climbed with me or developed with me knows that like I'll be like moving around little rocks or sticks, like so long as the ecosystem can sustain that, to make landings a little bit better. Because if you just like take 10 minutes or an hour to flatten things out, like every single person who climbs there after you is going to have a marginally better experience, like totally, forever, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I went to Zeph the like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and like, you just notice the little things. Like, was that you, by the way?
That was Will Englund. And oh, I mean, Will started it. Like, I had been climbing with that drop off, and like it was kind of sketchy. And then
it's a crazy drop off.
Will like came to watch me or something one day while I was trying, and he started stacking rocks. And then me and him and Mikey all built that little terrace, which is now much nicer.
Yeah, there's so much, many little nicer. Yeah, there's like so many little pleasant things. I think you're right. It just takes like 15 minutes, usually probably a little bit more, but that like you don't, people like me, it's I always had this thing with like bolting as well. Like I just go, like I just consume, and we should like take the time to notice like those types of things, and they totally add to the quality. And like, I mean, it'd be so curious to see what somebody does with sport climbing in this exact same type of scale list. Like there's so many little attributes that add to, you know, the purity of a sport climb as well, and a lot of things that take away.
Well, something that actually I was talking to Jamie about this, I think is kind of interesting, is that there's a reason why we're talking about this with bouldering and not sport climbing. And I think it kind of is a nod to something that maybe, you know, Jason Kale touched on with not as many rules, kind of a simplicity thing. And there's something about bouldering that you can do this on that, Tim, I'm not sure that you can, you know, I mean, we could do, I love sport climbing. We could have that discussion, but it almost made me think that with sport climbing, you think of it more like the crag. Like if you were to talk about what makes a great crag, cliff versus each unique climb is it's a little bit different. I mean, look, this is open for argument. I just mean, I think there's a reason why the star rating is such an attractive thing in bouldering over sport climbing. You could disagree with that.
I hear that. No, I definitely hear that. No, I hear that for sure. Yeah. And I actually like sport climbing, and I sport climb a lot.
I love
it. I 100%, I 100% agree with that.
All right. Did you have anything else on landing, or should we check off the last one, setting?
We can be done with landing, I think. Setting's the one that, like, I don't know how I feel about it. It's just so, like, I think everyone would agree that perched on top of a mountain with a gorgeous view is better than being like in a dump with garbage around you, which there are plenty of boulders like that. But it's just like, where do you draw the line between like whether it gets a star or not? And so I've kind of had it just as this like extra bonus thing. And I have been treating it as like, if it's just an otherworldly, like crown jewel perched on top of the hill, like, or the Revenant, that thing in Wyoming that Jimmy put up on our winds trip, which is just like sitting atop this alpine lake with the most stunning background. But I don't know, it's like I almost want to just remove it because it's so far removed from the boulder itself.
Crown jewel
so experiential
is a damn good example of that idea, and a good name too, by the way. Good job, Kyle Omiro, for doing that thing and naming it well. I feel like name is a subjective thing, but it does kind of like Slash Face, I think, is a really good name. I think that adds to the boulder. You mentioned the Revenant on your website, which has not been updated, so I will not hold you to it, but currently is the only boulder on your website that has a check mark for all of those attributes.
But really?
But there's a little backstory there that I find interesting that I talked to Jamie about, and he wanted to hear why you didn't think the Revenant was that good. Can you tell us about how you found, or how you and Jimmy and the crew that was out there found the Revenant, and what you thought of it and what you think of it now?
That's good that Jamie asked about that. And I think Jamie like loves to argue with me. We go back and forth about stuff. We're texting all the time, and he loves to be like, gotcha. And he is like, so he has thought about this stuff for so long, and he's definitely knows his stuff. And so at like, for instance, Sunseeker, he was always like, Sunseeker shouldn't be that high on the list. Like the landing's that old one. It took me like going to Sunseeker, and it took me like thinking about it more to come around. But for Revenant, yeah, we were in the winds, crazy trip, big hike, you know, hired mules for the first few miles. Like just, I don't know, could talk a lot about that experience in general, but we're up there developing boulders in this perfect, beautiful oasis with like alpine lakes and big meadows full of boulders and everything. And one of our trip organizers, Dobbin Bagdonis, who's like Mr. Wyoming, basically, he had done a recon hike around the lake. We're all kind of like exploring different zones and whatnot. And he had mentioned like, oh yeah, I found this big roost. It's like probably a B. And Jimmy actually like wasn't super psyched at that point in time. He was like working on some other stuff. But I was like, oh, that sounds sweet. So then I rallied myself, Dobbin and Jamie to walk over there the next day or something. And it wasn't like in incredible shape when we first found it. So like we did quite a bit of work that day, the three of us. We moved this massive boulder out from underneath of it that was kind of obscuring a start. And there was this like white kind of crust on a lot of the holds, which comes off, but like there's still a lot of it on the wall. It's just no longer on the holds. And if you wanted to, you could scrub it all off with wire brush. But yeah, we started cleaning it, built the landing out a decent amount. And I remember I thought it looked impossible and I was like, I don't think it goes. And Jamie was very confident that it went. And sure enough, we brought Jimmy the next day and, yeah, he did all the moves pretty quick. And I did like all but one move, I think. And it just, yeah, as we like continued to build the landing out more and scrub the holds more and clean it up, like it just turned into this like really spectacular problem. But it's not perfect. Like it starts on an undercling, which I think is like less obvious than a not undercling, because when you're looking at it, like you don't really see the hold.
Never thought.
Kind of disappears.
This.
And you can reach like multiple holds past it off the ground and start like in the middle of the problem since it's so steep. It's a little sharp. Like it was cutting me a little bit for sure. And Jimmy actually got this like horrible slapper on his first trip and had to come back a second time. But that hold's not so sharp anymore. So
okay. First things first, that's really good to know that the way pro climbers make sure they show up fresh is to use mules. So yeah, I'm gonna definitely make other people carry my stuff. And it's interesting hearing that story because Jamie's telling you, you saw the boulder and, you know, people were psyched. Jimmy was psyched and you were kind of like, is this it? Like, is this really that good? Like, are you sure? Like, we should be psyched on? And I found it really interesting that you all transformed it into something pretty special. And then Jamie's telling, and I have a hunch we'll someday bring, because I talked to Jamie yesterday, I was like, damn, maybe we should just get him on the pod tomorrow with Eric. But we had to give you the, you know, number one mic. And you know, this idea that it changed, you, as you all worked on it, and then that maybe later you came back as you kind of have gone through this quest and learned more and more that it, you reassessed, where it fit in. And I just think it's also fun to be able to take that climb and hear you wrestle with why or why not different things should have a star, and you know, even that undercling example or reaching the holds. I think all this is really cool, and there we'll link that that video in the show notes. Mm-hmm. I remember when it came out. It looks beautiful. That area looks, yeah, that definitely gets a star for sure.
Yeah,
no matter what.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting for sure, and I think that trip, like, I learned so much about developing boulders. And I'd done a lot of development up to that point, but I'd never developed in Talus before. So I learned so much about how like those landscapes can change and shift with moving rocks around and like how much of the surface is actually climbable. So like at first when we got there, we ran around the Talus and I was like, I don't know, dude, there's not like any megas. Then sure enough, like with enough work, all these things started appearing. So I learned a lot from Roman and Jimmy and Dobbin and all those guys about that. And yeah, when we first rolled up to Revenant, like it just looks so much different than it does now. And so I think at first I was like, like, should we move this giant rock? Like, should we scrub this? But you know, I think you always got to try. And as I develop more and more, I'm finding that if you just like scrub holds, put chalk on, like lines will appear, things will, like, usually there's more than you think. So
that's a cool story.
Interesting.
Tim, hearing this, it makes me appreciate that. We grew up in California where I've done a decent amount of traveling. I'm not, you know, super well experienced traveling, but going to Buttermilks and going to Yosemite and talking about these lines versus kind of creating something out of the Talus, it just always struck me that Yosemite and Bishop have some of the most impressive lines I've come across in the world. And I remember going to Colorado and, you know, you're in Lincoln Lake or Rocky Mountain National Park. And it's like there's climbs everywhere, but you didn't see one when you were walking up the trail. You weren't walking up the trail.
Totally.
And you go, oh, that's that one that I've been watching the videos of. And it's just interesting to hear about that from a developer standpoint, where you have a lot of experience you know, what the eye actually can find and what you guys have made out of something that's not so obvious, which is both really cool and also just makes me appreciate what you and me have, Tim. And
Totally. Yeah. No, I definitely also had the same feeling. Like, I remember going to RMNP for the first time and like not being as, I don't know what it was, but it was definitely that where like I couldn't, you know, climbing wasn't the same thing to me. It was still like the actual movement of the climbing and like sending and stuff was the same, but like I didn't realize how much I appreciated seeing like pure lines and pure boulders and, you know, pure landscapes and stuff like that. Like, I mean, I think that's why I'm so like, I'm just fascinated hearing you talk about it. You know, I think like it's a controversial topic because you are creating the scale that is an objective scale for all of these subjective concepts. But I think that's what makes it so cool. I think that's why people respect Jamie or maybe argue with Jamie so much, but he's a sheriff because, you know, we're all talking about subjective experiences. But, you know, I will say, Eric, I hope you, first of all, I wish you the best luck with all this stuff, but also like, I hope that you become, you know, more opinionated about these things. And because I think that's what makes it so cool to hear about, you know, I like asking you about your experiences on these things, like your personal thoughts based on your objective scale or the scale that's like trying to be objective. But I think at the end of the day, these are all like personal experiences and subjective. But, you know, I think everybody plays a game, right? Like everybody in climbing plays this game where like we're looking for the best, we're looking for this, we're looking for that, whatever. And like the more we define the game, the more enjoyable it is to play it or like to avoid it or, you know, to be like, well, today I'm not going to play the game, like whatever for these things. And then, but then also for me, it's just fascinating because Josh, you're right. Like just appreciating things that we've had in the past and like, you know, seeing like why things happen and then hearing about these stories is so, so cool. It's so cool to me. This is definitely like, I'm just listening a lot of it. And then I'm like, oh, I have an experience that relates. Like it's a totally unique podcast experience for me too. So this is awesome.
Okay. Well, I've got a couple of just kind of, you know, quick questions around this that after talking about the Revenant, it kind of shows why it's fun to pick out specific boulders. So I'm just gonna go really quickly I want you to just be able to say whatever pops into your head versus, you know, mull over it and use your website to see what's actually quote unquote best objectively. Is when I say best boulder, which one pops into your head?
I had Western Gold as the best for a long time and pretty damn good. It's not perfect. It's got its flaws, but, at the tension center the other day, Tristan told me that he met a guy who said he climbed into the crack out left, which like, I think everyone was always like, yeah, you could probably do that, but I hadn't known of anyone actually doing it. So then it makes Western Gold contrived and I had to move it like way down the list, which is a sad moment because I love that boulder, but I've really been thinking so much about how like, we just haven't found it yet. Like, there's good boulders, but we've not found the one that's out there.
That's cool.
Yeah. Exciting.
That was one of Jamie's things is what about all the boulders we haven't found yet? You know, and I think that you've left wiggle room in everything we've talked about to acknowledge that there's more coming. Okay. Then how about the best easy climb? And I don't care what easy means to you. Just, you know, what comes to mind?
Should I pull up the single digits list
no,
as well?
Or? And also it's not on the website. No, I don't want, I just, yeah. Okay, sure. You actually, while you're doing that, I want to do this to Tim too. What's, when I said best boulder, what popped into your head, Tim?
Oh. Ooh. That is tough. I didn't have anything that came up in mind. I don't think I've climbed like the best boulders out there. You know, I think I've heard like, even climbs like Western Gold, I've heard are, you know, maybe one of the best boulders, but man, I don't know. I don't know what I would consider. I think I've climbed a lot of like outdoor boulders more recently in my last couple of years than ever. And a lot of them have just been like really fun experiences. And I don't, like I said before, I don't consider like the best, like I have those like afterthoughts in my head or like in the moment, I'm like, yeah, for sure. This is like a phenomenal boulder or like this one's totally not, but I'm mostly just like trying to climb and send. But
come on, what pops in your head? Okay, just
God, because okay, I was thinking like specific boulders that I've done in the past, but based on this whole conversation, they actually are not the best anymore. But I would have said Wet Dream was one of the best boulders I've done for a long time.
Lame sit
But it definitely
star.
Like loses yeah. stars.
Dude,
yeah, lame,
sit down.
Arbitrary star like, holds. Just,
there's
like, doesn't make sense.
Emissions. There's Wet Dream right. I don't even, yeah, terrible, yeah. terrible climb. Why would anyone do that? Okay, well.
Spectre, like I said, Spectre was for sure like near the top okay. of my list for a long time. But again, it totally.
Okay, Eric, did you bring up the website and what's the
I
easy
I took
one?
A look, yeah. Yeah, I think like the Southeast, you know, New River Gorge have a lot of the best easy climbs that I've experienced. I think one of the best that no longer has access, unfortunately, is a V5 at the New River Gorge called Don't Feed the Monkey. It's just, it's really, really good. Or there was this one Scud Buster, this V6 that I unfortunately pioneered like an alternate entrance into, but if it worked for that, it'd be maybe the best. I didn't do the first ascent. I cleaned it and started trying it, and then I had to leave. And Eric Schneider did it.
Okay. But, what about best moderate then?
Oh,
I guess you said
I guess V6, I was thinking like
typically. Yeah, you just think under yeah. V10, huh? Okay.
I guess the hard part is like when it comes to like easy problems, there's so frequently are just like so many holds, and it's hard for it to be like super yeah. pure. But they do exist out there. This one has some flaws, but like Natasha's Highball is very good.
I was going to say Natasha's Highball. I love Natasha's Highball.
Yeah, that's a really good problem. Big Bud and Devil's Lake, I haven't done, but it looks really cool. The Maiden in Waco is pretty fun. Jamie would say it's not a boulder, it's a cliff line though.
Yeah, I hate those cliff lines too. I totally agree. I guess moderates, I was thinking more along like the V6 to V10 or 11. It is hard to find really cool, easy climbs. For me, the ones that I was going to say Storming the Castle. I don't know if you guys have done that one in LRC, but that's like close to a solo. That thing is tall. I think Heavenly Path is incredible. It's right there when you walk up. It has this obvious big hole where it shifts from vertical to slabby. I just think there's something special about that one. I think those are kind of the two. The Hesitator, I still think the Hesitator is pretty freaking amazing.
I have a question.
I think there's.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say, I think that there's like, when I like my issue with doing the single digits list has been that like, I only really know like the classic ones, and the classics ones are often classic because they're good, but not always. And like, there's just so many easier boulder problems that like, there's got to be a lot that check all the boxes that I've never heard of and will have to just stumble upon or have someone text to me or something. And
totally.
Yeah, there's just like so many boulders. It's easier to do the double digits because there's just so fewer.
How about Teenage boulders. Lobotomy? Is that, have you seen anything in Waco?
I haven't been to Squamish, but.
I mean, Squamish. Yeah.
The one.
No, I meant Squamish.
Yeah, I haven't been to Squamish, but looks amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Have you done that one?
I have, yeah. It's wild. It's definitely.
Is the landing okay?
We had like 30 pads, literally. It's a little weird because it kind of starts out on a slab and then it gets vertical. So there's an element of this. There's a fear that you might land on the slab if you fall, but I don't think that the reality is there that you do. And so, yeah, I would say it kind of has a two-tiered landing, but with enough pads, you can stack it up and then make it all flat. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that's got to be really high up on their really striking feature, pretty much straight up and down.
Yeah. Mm. Too bad it's not in North America, or it's not in the United States.
can't make it on the top 100?
This list is the United States.
Okay.
USA.
You guys kind of glossed over a point that I find really interesting, or Eric just kind of glossed over a point that I find really interesting, that I think like hard boulders have a significance to like better, you know, sorry, that the word of better climbing is really hard to say, but like, it seems that your list, first of all, was like very hard climb heavy. But also like, it seems like to me, the understanding is the list would be hard climb heavy, just for a lot of things. I think it's totally interesting. It's a totally different discussion, I think, as to like, is harder climbing better climbing? But that's not necessarily what I was trying to make a point of. But it is like clear that you were like highlighting more of like the medium hard or harder climbs in terms of what exists.
I, So like one thing Max brought up in his little write-up about this is that harder boulders tend to be better because there's like less features and like the lines are more surgical and pure. And right. It's interesting that if you like count the number of each grade in the, at least in the double digits, B13 has the most on the list. I think there's like 28 or something. And it, I think there's like a sweet spot. And then when it gets too hard, like the quality just, they're so rare that the quality like can't frequently be that high, I guess. Like none of the V16s are super, super inspiring to me. They're all like
totally
kind of okay, you know?
A best grade for you that you've witnessed over time?
I think like I've kind of been like developing as a climber. And so for a long time, I was climbing just like a ton of V10s. And V10 is a really, really good grade in the US. Like there's just so many of them. But like, I think the last few years, I've like tried to seek out a lot of the B12s on the list. And now I've like done most of, maybe not most, but probably about half of the V12s or something. And so now I'm like, okay, now it's time to like level up and like start tackling the V13s. And so I'm excited to get into that grade a little bit more and hopefully travel for some more of those problems with like the ambition of doing them and not just checking them out.
Nice.
But V10's pretty fun, man. It's just a good grade.
I had a question earlier when Josh was asking you questions also about do you have like what are your favorite boulders, maybe like your top two or top three that, you know, regardless of this list, like what are your favorite boulders that you've done? And do they happen to have like, are they close to this list? Or are they like totally not? Like, yeah, well, I'm just curious what your favorite boulders are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really hard question, but I would say it's like all stuff in New River Gorge and they're all really good boulders. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So they happen to like correlate for you. They're close.
Yeah. I don't really have any favorites that are like bad boulders that come to mind at least.
What about, go ahead, guys.
I was just going to say that, like, what I climbed with Bryce Viola and Brian Nugent when they were on their big road trip, and they got me psyched on doing, like, they each have a list of their personal top 10 for each grade.
Oh, cool.
And so I have that somewhere in my phone that probably needs to be updated, but
that would be cool
fun,
to get, like,
fun little thing to
every pro climber's top 10 boulders. Must do boulders.
Yeah, right.
I'd love to hear those guys have climbed some amazing boulders. And shout out to Bryce, who just had a mega trip in Rocklands. I would love to hear. I'd love to hear everyone's top 10. That'd be so fun.
I guess it's worth noting, like, I think I touched on this in another podcast that I did a few years ago about the list, but the list, like, I talked to a ton of pro climbers and experienced climbers. And so I can't take credit for all of this. That's for sure. And I got just that. Like, Carlo, what are your top 10 in the valley? You know, and just asking around kind of the regional experts for each area and hidden gems I might not have heard of and things like that. Nice. And so it's very collaborative in that sense. And it was in the hopes of getting a complete picture of the climbing in the US.
I'm surprised Outer Limits isn't on this list. Did you take a look at that when you were out here? I know. I was there.
It broke.
It was sad. It was very sad.
It was on the list. So I also have an honorable mention list, which has not been added to that website yet, but that includes like amazing climbs that have broken, things like Wrinkle in Time that are over the water, things with poor access. So
yeah. What about Yabble Roof? That's got poor access now. That's close.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. That's on the honorable mention list.
That's sad. Okay. We could, look at the list, but, just while I got you, what jumps out in your head when I say the best boulder in these areas? There's Bishop, Joe's, Waco, I'm just going to say the South and the Northeast. And you know, I just want it because I thought that when we talked about some of your goals long-term with this project was to let there be a feed for new boulders that get put up, or that there's this concept that if someone travels and they go to Japan or something, like you were saying, this gives them an idea of what they could maybe get on. And so if someone said to you, oh, hey, Eric, I'm going to Joe's, you know, what would be the number one boulder that I need to go do?
Yeah. And I actually get that DM like fairly often, like probably every couple weeks, someone's like, I'm going to Joe's. Like, what should I get on? And it's honestly like pretty annoying because I'm like, I mean, it's fine. Like, I'll text them back, but I'm like, man, just like watch some YouTube videos or something. Like there's so much information about Jays. It's not like they're asking about some obscure area that only I know about or whatever. But well, anyway,
you can kill thousands of birds with one stone by telling us right here the top boulder for all those areas. Cause I'm in your DMs asking you right now, dude.
Yeah. Jays. There's a few that come to mind. Black Dahlia is really good at the minecart area. That's put up by Mike Bocchino. There's a few that Kira Madsit put up at this low key area called the Far Side. There's Built by a Goddess, which I think is the really, really good one. It's about B8 or B9. Incredible boulder. I think there's a video somewhere on my Instagram of that if you go back far enough. And certainly on Kaya. And then I'm trying to think of like a good, easier one. Fly the Sky is a really great like V0 super tall jug haul thing that I mean, maybe it's not like objectively the best, but it's just really a good time and everyone has a really enjoyable experience on it.
I can't believe The Wind Below didn't get mentioned. I always thought that was one of the
oh yeah, that,
real special.
No, you're right.
Ones
that's the best Joe's. One.
Like, I, yeah, if I could just say
that's the best one. Yeah.
Trent's Mom is pretty freaking cool. But Wind Below and also a good name. Yeah. Really good name there.
Yeah. Good shout. That's a really good one.
Okay. Well, I won't make you do it for Bishop and Yosemite and Waco and the South. And
well, you know, but the whole thing is like there's a down. Search bar on that website. And so once the website's done, like that's hopefully a resource for people who are planning trips or hoping to explore a new area so that they can search like California and see all the best boulders in California ranked. And
that's so epic. That's like the dream, right? Like that's if for, you know, like any climber, you can't really do that. Like you can find climbing and stuff, right? And you can go to YouTube and stuff, but you can't, like, if you want a streamlined opinion, you know, right to you from an expert who's done a lot of these climbing or like ask people around, like there isn't a list like that available or easily accessible, right? Do you have areas that you obviously have to go to still that you haven't been to yet or boulders?
Yeah, definitely. I have a lot of travel still. I've been to like most of the major areas in the US. North Carolina was one that I checked out for the first time last season. And I still have like quite a lot to do there. So I'll probably go back for at least a little bit this season. Roy, New Mexico, I've never been to. I haven't done a lot of climbing in California. Yeah,
I've never had a reason to go to Roy, but I want to go.
I'm kind of conflicting because my main objectives in my climbing right now are developing first ascents and like a few projects that I have, and that like it's really hard to do that and go climb volume at a new area, but it's nice to like spread out the top 100 questing over time in that way and like kind of use it as a reprieve from the projecting mindset and everything. Like I can project for a couple months and I can go check out Roy or whatever, and so just trying to take my time and savor the experience a little bit.
Rough. Sounds like nice. You're really busy developing sweet areas, climbing the best boulders in the world.
That's what I really want to do is like develop boulders that make the list. You know what I mean? And I have one that has made the list that I think will hold. It's really good. It's in Zion and people should go climb it because it doesn't have many ascents yet. But I just want to like keep exploring. It's called Promised Land. So I keep exploring and keep finding things that are like, yeah, there's a video on my YouTube.
Okay, I'll link that.
Want to find like boulders that like are in the top 20, you know, or like add my name to the list in multiple places. Because at one point I counted up like all the different first ascensionists and like Jimmy has the most by far. And then like everyone who makes that list, like all those first ascensionists are pretty prolific people. Like you'd have heard of all of them, which is pretty cool. So I want to try and leave a positive impact on the community by contributing some. Mm-hmm.
And you're not even bringing up Jimmy outside the U.S. Just that right. Video, that latest Swiss video of Jimmy just putting up amazing things that look like five stars. On that note, the one question that I still do have for you was from Max Olatukin, and he wanted to hear more about developing in Wyoming. And I want to tie it into what you were just saying where, remember one of the first things when we were doing our pre-interview was just this idea of that intersection of developing something that's, you know, has a high, the three attributes were FA, high ball, and start quality. And I just think that's a really cool, I just like that you have this idea in your climbing. You're like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to develop the best boulders in the world. And, you know, the high ball is a personal love of yours too. And so just, you know, props to you for having, I think it's important to have a goal, to have this, like, this is what I'm here for. And, you know, that really will probably take you to some of the coolest places in the world. And you can comment on that, but yeah, just want to hear about what you're doing in Wyoming. What are you making out there?
Yeah, I'm kind of over Wyoming a little bit, actually, just for the moment. Like, I'll probably go back, but I spent a lot of time there. Like, I had a multi-year project in the Tetons that I wrapped up last year. And then I, like, tried the multiverse for a bit and did that. And it was, like, a lot of driving through, like, dirt roads and stuff. So I'm ready to, like, take a little break from Wyoming and explore other places. I'm mostly psyched on developing.
That it's like, yeah, Wyoming sucks, guys. Like, don't go there and steal my.
No, Wyoming's the climbing's amazing. The climbing's amazing. It's just like kind of taxing. Like, it's rugged out there after over time. And I'm like, if I'm going to develop boulders, I want to develop on like the best rock. And so I'm seeking out that. And so I'm trying to spend a lot more time in West Virginia this year. And then there's an area in Utah that I've been developing since 2019 or 2020 that I haven't really publicized much about it because I'm working with the Utah Parks and Recreation Department and like the local organization that owns that land to like really solidify access and make it really sustainable. Because like, I just listened to a podcast with Bernd Zangerl on the Nugget, and he talked about how much he's seen Magicwood change and how he's trying to do it differently this time around when he's developing new areas and make it like really sustainable. And so there's a lot of cryptobiotic soil in that area. And I want to make sure that the trail system is like really built and like really obvious, so no one is stepping on that crypto soil and like ruining the ecosystem there. So that area is really, really cool. The rock's really amazing. And it's like another area for Utah people to go to besides like Joes Valley and Little Cottonwood. And so I'm excited to hopefully bring that to people. I'll probably do a guide in Kaya and bring that to people hopefully in the next year or two.
Wow.
But then, yeah, awesome. Just like, it's a cool zone. And I can't take full credit. Like, people climbed there before me. Like, there was a crew that started the development in 2007 and then they kind of like abandoned it and I picked up where they left off. But that's been a fun project. And then, yeah, like, there's some stuff in West Virginia that I've been climbing on that's really, really good. But I didn't find them myself. Other local climbers have found them. And so, like, when I'm looking for what I'm looking for, like, in my life is something that's like right at my limit of difficulty. It's tall. It's a perfect boulder. Like, it fits all those criteria. And I found it myself. Like, I want to be the one to stumble upon it and have that full experience of like taking it from nothing to something.
Nice, man. Sounds like, yeah, I had a
small question before that. Do you think it's going to happen? It seems like a pretty obvious question. Like, you know, it seems like people are on like either end of this where like, yeah, obviously there are endless boulders out there in the world. But what do you think? Like, do you think some of the best have been found already? Do you think like the vast majority of the best have been found? Do you think you're going to find them?
I think like the true best are out there unfound. The world's so vast and so many places are just so inaccessible by car. Mm-hmm. So I think like in the future, in like 200 years or whatever, people will be helicoptering around looking for boulders and flying in. And I mean, even Jamie and those guys are about to go to Alaska on an expedition and I think they're getting flown in. And so that's kind of, I mean, there's just so much terrain out there. There's got to be a perfect boulder somewhere. But I think just like in climbing, it's all about the pursuit. Like, you can't be focused on the sand. You got to be focused on enjoying the path to it. And so in the same way, like, I'll probably never find that boulder that I'm looking for. I'll probably find things that are close and have great experience. But like, it's all about just enjoying the process and hiking around the woods and getting lost and gifting new first ascents to people in the community.
Eric, yeah, you're just all that good chasing the dragon of the 6-star boulder, just always looking over the next hill. it's really cool. I just wanted to highlight what you're talking about where bringing in a new area and doing it in the right way. And it reminds me of something that Dave Gurman said about you and just how he really respected that approach you had to the community that, you know, we've been sitting here just geeking out about like the, you know, what makes a boulder really good. And that's definitely like this myopic view of bouldering and just being out there, you know, having an impact on, you know, nature, but then doing it in the right way so that people enjoy it and being a steward for our sport. Just wanted to let you know that people have, you know, called out how others, you do a really good job of that. And I think that's really important. you know, something that me and Tim talk about often is how there's not a lot of mentors in our sport anymore. It grew so fast. People grow up in the gym. There's no one who lets them know that, hey, maybe you shouldn't be blaring your boombox and taking a dump right next to a boulder. And we can, you know, act like that's really dumb. Those people are idiots. But the truth is if no one kind of sets that example and, you know, raises their hand and does the right thing, then what do we expect? You know, so just thanks for, acknowledging that side of it. And yeah, that's what you want out of someone who's developing is not, it's like you're creating that, you're starting that experience and then making sure it's set up for success all the way through. So thanks, man.
Yeah, that was nice. Thank you. I think that something Will Anglin and I were chatting about before he went on your show, we went out climbing and we're discussing topics that might come up and what we might want to talk about. And I don't know if you end up talking about it with him, but we mentioned how like climbing has this kind of consumerist mentality, especially among younger climbers, it seems. And I think we all have periods of our climbing where it's all about like checking boxes and ticking things. But like, just a reminder to, I'm sure there's a lot of like youth comp climbers listening to this podcast, and just a reminder to like enjoy each experience, respect each other, respect the places that you're climbing and the climbs. And, you know, it's not all about just like take, 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 tick, tick, tick. Like, yeah. Have a good time.
How do I become a pro climber, Eric? How do I get sponsored? How do I get paid?
It's about money. Yeah. That's what climbing is about.
Such a good point.
Money.
Climbers have an inherently bad like focus to the end result. And, you know, what a great reminder to just enjoy it. And that's how you're going to get to the end result anyway. But, you know, take the fixation off the end results, maybe pick some different end results that are just more sustainable for your life and enjoy it. But thanks for living it and sharing the process. That's awesome.
Well, I'm glad we brought it all the way back to our contentious beginning with pro climbing. And we established that Eric is in fact a pro climber. So I'm going to ask you, Eric, what is your pro tip for our listeners?
Oh yeah, I wrote a couple down.
You're
quick tips,
multiple pro tip kind of pro. Okay.
I mean, I don't have to share all of them, but I think I wrote three down. One thing that I think is kind of interesting that we could talk about, because we're reaching a broader network here through the podcast, is like cleaning holds, not just brushing holds, but actually cleaning holds with water. And it's a nuanced discussion because different rock reacts differently to things like that. But my friend Matt DeSantis made a good post recently after visiting New Zealand, where the ethic there is like every single person scrubs down every boulder with water after every ascent or after every session to preserve the rock, because the rock there gets really polished really fast. And you see polish happening at a much faster rate now as people are brushing holes less and climbing more. And so on certain harder rock types like granite, gneiss, schist, probably like a lot of them can tolerate a good scrub with water to get the chalk and the rubber off, which will preserve the longevity. It'll go a long way for that. And rubbing alcohol can be used too. Exercise caution with sandstone for sure. But if it's like hard, good sandstone and a very soft, light brushing, I think can be okay. I'm not a geologist and hopefully like someone will like write a cool article about it or something. But I think like to preserve all of these great boulders that we're talking about and even the bad boulders, like that would be a nice thing for people to start implementing a little bit more. And of course, brush your hold, like at the very, very least with a soft brush. In terms of like performance, I actually like had a list of tactics on my phone that I started when I was like 14 or something, and I stopped adding to it a few years ago, but I should probably start again. And two of the tactics I pulled from there that I thought were kind of fun were, one is exhaling on moves that require flexibility or length. If you just like exhale as you're doing the move, you can either like fit into a box that you didn't think you could, or you can extend your reach a little bit. Also exhaling on dead points kind of like works as like a slow motion type thing. I think Nita Williams maybe told me that. And it's totally true. Like if you're ever dead pointing and like missing or being inaccurate, exhaling as you do the move just like slows down time for some reason. And then my other one would be climb faster. Like if you have a sequenced out and you keep falling at the end for some reason, just like pick up the pace and all of a sudden you'll be sending. Those are my, awesome. My little tips.
Awesome. I gotta get on that second pro tip. I coach breath work like constantly in, you know, literally any session that I coach. And because I think breath work is a great director of our performance. That's not one that I coach, though, is that exhaling through dead points and exhaling through flexibility is super fascinating. So the breath work that I coach often are either revs, so rev control, so that's exhales after you do movements. So like rewarding hard movement with exhales is a great place, because I see that climbers inherently climb in the same rev range where they should be, you know, high and low more often. And so to get the high rev range, I teach brace breathing. So inhales before you create anything, any sort of tension, impact, generation of momentum. But I think that, you know, a fascinating concept for me has been like SOTS, like, you know, outward exhales, noise, breaths. And I think I SOT a lot. I, you know, set up for a move, I inhale, like go for a move, and I generally make a noise or an exhale as I do the move. And I think that's fascinating to like control the motion, you know, add the accuracy, like slow down the time, I think is a cool point.
Thanks for those, Eric. And really think it's cool what you're doing, where you're making another list that's not just focused on grades. And I think that does tie into the consumptive experience, or trying to avoid just always going for a harder grade. I mean, I guess you could argue that going for higher star qualities can be consumptive, but I think it's a bit of a different pursuit that at the very least, you know, can give people a joy that isn't always tied into their physical performance, which can degrade from injury or getting older or having kids. Just kidding. I really appreciate us breaking down all of those attributes. And, you know, I'm going to look at boulders different now. How's the rock? How's the line?
Me too.
Does it start in the right place? Like, do I think this is a good start? Is this tall enough to be cool in the landing and the setting? And that's a lot of stars, 6 stars. For everyone listening, please give our podcast 6 stars. Actually, only 5 stars on the podcast, but there's a little shout out. And Eric, I wanted you to plug one last time, your website, the YouTube you're doing this on, because I really just want to follow along. And I think it's a great resource for people. I think what you're building, I know it's still nascent, but there's something special about what you're doing. So let us know where to follow along and what you're building.
Yeah. You can follow me on Instagram. Sometimes I post more than others. It's eric.jerome. I have a YouTube that's also just my name. And there's like kind of videos where as I travel to these boulders, I'll break them down and show those qualities. And they're like, okay, like some are better than others. I feel like I could do a better job, and I'm going to try and do a better job. It's just hard. Like life's busy. There's a lot of stuff going on. Same with the website. The website is not done yet. I guess there's no harm in letting people see the work in progress. So if you want to check it out, it's top100.dev, and we'll probably eventually shift that to top100.best when it's complete. And yeah, those are pretty much the only platforms I use. So
nice. I got a second. Follow Eric Jerome on Instagram. It's like, for me, some of the more entertaining, just like rants, opinions, like you had a one where you were like looking for the best challah bread for a long time, like, and you just rate those. Like, I find those types of things fascinating. Like, people are looking for coffee shops and stuff, but like, I don't know, you're always bringing up like thoughtful topics and like, you know, stuff that's probably controversial, but you bring it up in a way that is like, I don't know, focused on the topic and the discussion. So it's cool. I love it.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I want to try and be more active, but then everything else in my life is screaming at me to not be more active on social media. So tough balance for everyone, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the antidotes to that is, instead of just being active on social media, you create something like that website, or the YouTube channel that kind of lasts forever, right? Like, you know, like taking all that experience and putting it into something that people can utilize is like the culmination of those little snippets we got on Instagram. So thanks for doing that. And I'm looking forward to talking to you in a couple of years when you've done all the 100, you have an even better idea about what they'll be. And it'll be fun to see what gets kicked off in that time and what gets added.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
All right. Guys,
oh yeah. Eric, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thanks so much for having me. That was great. That was really fun.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Really awesome. Appreciate it. That was super fun. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.